It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. A great show for you. The inside story of how Twitter got hatched with Nick Bilton, Will Harris, and Harper Reed join us. We're going to talk tech in just a moment on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 431, recorded November 10th, 2013. Rhymes with ass word. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at Gazelle.com. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. And by Go to Assist from Citrix. Take control of your IT world from one simple cloud-based platform. Provide live or unattended support to all your users anywhere. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today at GoToAssist.com. Use the promo code TWIT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use our offer code TWIT11. It's time for Twit, This Week in Tech. What a show we got for you today! This is the show where we talk about the week's tech news and a great panel. Nick Bilton sitting right next to me. We've been trying to get Nick in since his blistering hot, blows the lid off of Twitter book came out, Hatching Twitter.
You can go to hatchingtwitter.com to buy it. It comes in all forms and sizes. Harper endorses the book, right, Harper?
Yes.
Yes, see, look at that enthusiasm.
My name is Harper Reed, and I endorse this message. Hatching Twitter, a true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. Nick Bilton, could have been better time. Of course, the Twitter IPO this week. We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah. Also with us from our good friend from across the pond, Mr. Will Harris, sitting on a snow-white couch in Oxford. At Will Harris.
It's actually London now, Leo. I've moved to the Big Smoke.
Oh, wow. So that's after you sold the channel, and you're living high. Are you living in the Shard? What is it with London? Exactly. Every building has a nickname.
Yeah, well, they've all got nicknames because they all have to be a little bit different because they all have to sort of out-prestige one another.
Right.
So it has to be, you know, you've got the Gherkin, then you've got the Shard, then you've got, the next one will be something else.
It's so nutty. Also with us, Harper Reed. It's great to have you back. Harper was our guest on Triangulation. And and at the time, he was the guy responsible, to a great degree, responsible for the Obama campaign's 2008 digital strategy.
That's true.
And since then, what have you been up to?
Mostly just laying on my floor. I try not to do much.
The ACA website, let's get this straight, is not your fault.
It may be because I was laying on my floor. Those may be related. Well, actually, no. It is not my fault. And it's actually a pretty, interesting kind of situation. One where if I was involved, I think that the cronyism would be very active. And we don't want that. But the procurement system is very bad. So
can you explain a little bit about how these kinds of things happen? I mean, it took 3 years to build and 10 minutes to break. I mean, look, I covered the Valley and tech startups, but I'm curious how, and sometimes they break and sometimes they don't, but how do you think this kind of happened?
I think the first thing is that it's an unprecedented size of a consumer app for the government. And I think that's the first thing, is that it's just a very large app. I mean, normally an application that you build doesn't have automatically 300 million users that are, able to log in and participate. The next thing is that the procurement system of the government is just brutal, where it's when you're trying to do technology and the organizations you're working with, the smartest guys in the rooms are the lawyers instead of the tech folks. I think that's when we have a problem. And so for the most part, you have these great organizations that are doing great work, but they're maximizing their abilities on lawyering procurement contract, not on technology. And so there's this meme that, if we just added some Silicon Valley style technologists to the mix, that things would be better. And this kind of started with like the idea of tech surge and all that stuff. But the problem is until we get rid of or make more efficient the procurement laws and make it so that people like us could actually participate in a real way, then it doesn't matter. You're still going to get crap product.
So how are they going to fix it?
There's been a lot of talk from the White House about fixing and really making the procurement process easier for great small contracting firms to kind of get involved. And I think that's the first step, is from the White House kind of pushing down some policies, et cetera, some ideas. Todd Park, the CTO of the White House, has done a really good job of kind of starting this process, being very public about it. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, there were a lot of people who there was a couple of days on Twitter where everyone was suggesting that I step in and help, which would not have solved anything. But because of that, a lot of people emailed and, you know, so, you know, I just say, hey, why don't you quit your job and help out? And no one's willing to do that. So I think it's a lot of talk. And I think that if you have a better opportunity to get people into the door of the White House to help out, into these great organizations, et cetera, then I think more people will participate. But until then, it's easy for us to sit in our, you know, armchairs and talk about how we would have done it differently.
Look at Leo sitting in his fancy armchair.
I got it. I'm looking at healthcare Sherpa. It seems to work. A couple of guys in Silicon Valley designed this, and they're free time. Of course, it doesn't connect to anything.
that's the other thing about this is, you know, the healthcare.gov it connects to, I have no idea how many
50 state databases, and then, I mean, it's crazy.
I connected to like three databases on the campaign, and I sometimes wished I was dead. You know, you have all of these different companies who have no interest in working together, and then you have this kind of glue that's supposed to wrap it all together, and it barely works. And from a technology standpoint, I think they probably did a pretty good try. It's just, it's hard. We all know
it's
that.
Absolutely
from the beginning.
Hard. Yeah.
The real issue, though, is I think they knew even months before, certainly days before the launch, that it wasn't going to work.
This is the real issue.
Yeah, and they were mandated by Congress to launch it regardless on October 1, right?
Well, and I think the other problem is when it comes to politics in Washington, you have two parties, and one is waiting for the slightest. I mean, that thing could have worked, and there could have been like one button that was pink instead of blue, and the Republicans.
Well,
would have
but
come
let's
out
be
in
fair,
force.
Nick.
But
it really didn't work.
It really didn't.
I mean, it wasn't like really kind of broken.
Yes.
I can't remember the numbers. But it was like 1,600 people were able to sign up the first day. It really didn't work.
But it's one of those things that was just a total no-win situation for the people involved, because if it didn't work, it's a total disaster and government can't do anything. And if it did work and, you know, millions of people signed up, then, you know, we're bankrupting the country and, you know, it's the biggest threat to America since, you know, communism or whatever, everything else. Like, it's literally like a no-win situation, whether it's great or not.
I think it would be safest to avoid the partisan political discussion, because admittedly there are people out with the long knives for this, no matter what. But to really say, is there a technical issue? And I think part of the issue is that government moves at a completely different speed and has a completely different system of working together than technology. Government works by consensus, by committee, by compromise. Technology is the antithesis of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no compromise. It either works or it doesn't work. In fact, you must have faced this a little bit, Harper, trying to bring technology into... I know you talked about this a little bit on our interview when you moved into the White House, ready to become the most transparent administration of all time. You had to face Windows XP and...
And then you started laying down on the floor and haven't gotten up since.
That's pretty much it. But one of the other things to, you know, keep in mind here is this is probably the biggest consumer application the government has ever made. There's nothing else that is close
precedent
to this size.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
I mean, not counting the NSA, of course, but yes.
How many users does this proposed NSA app have? Like, you know, 50, maybe 100?
Yeah. Yeah.
How many users? I mean, I think this is something I keep hearing when I travel. People say, well, you know, there's so many bugs in the healthcare.gov app, but why aren't there any bugs in the NSA app? And it's like, well, I bet there were.
Yes. And there were lots of apps too. So.
Yeah, and there's a number of apps and like four users.
Yeah.
But it's a good, interesting.
But there's a reason government's designed to be inefficient. The founding fathers wanted it to be inefficient because they were afraid of an efficient government. They have the three branches, each designed to slow the other down. This is how it's supposed to be. The problem is that doesn't work so well on a website.
Yeah, so, it's just not a great way to do development.
Right. No. And that's what was happening, I gather. I mean, Harper, did anybody call you and say, Harper, you know, get in here?
Is there
and,
a red phone, no. that you, like a red iPhone
no.
that you have?
I mean, I every time that comes up, I kind of try and hide those phones, and I hang up a lot.
I can't hear you. I'm in my bathtub.
Exactly. It's breaking up. Prank caller. But the real issue is we don't want a world where the government could reach out and call me.
Right.
Because that's aggressively cronyism. Right. We want a government right. where they can reach out and hire the best contractors for the job, which may honestly be someone in Silicon Valley. Right. And, you know, if they would have called me, I probably would have said no, because I think it probably would have sucked a lot, and I don't want to do that. With that said, you know, I would love to help create, and I think Clay Johnson and I wrote a New York Times op-ed specifically talking about how can we fix the procurement system, because that's where the problem is.
Yeah,
it's not. I mean, it's a tech problem now, but it's because the procurement system sucked.
Yeah, no, it was a good piece. So I have something funny that happened today on the way here.
Nick Bilton, what happened to you on the way here?
I was like, oh, I'm on with Will Smith, and he doesn't look like the person that I Googled.
Would you say wickety wah just a couple of times?
If you just Google, sorry, Will Harris. If you Google Will Harris with two L's, this was who I thought was coming.
A different Will Harris.
Make sure you use two L's.
Is it the
L's,
guy who's
one.
Like Whoa. The ex like meth head jazz musician or something?
Oh no, it's better than that. Oh. This guy could
it
be
sounds like it's a porn
meth.
Star. Should I really go to this
to
site?
See this guy?
Oh my God, Will, you're buff.
Look how buff you are, Will.
Look at you. He's an American professional baseball player and apparently a bodybuilder.
Yep. Nice work.
For the Diamondbacks. Wow. Will, you're looking good.
I've literally never looked better or anything like that.
I guess that's the other Will Smith. There's multiple Will Smiths.
Multiple Will Harrises.
I mean, Harrises. There's only one Will Smith, I just want to say.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint, Nick.
Yeah.
I'm just literally disappointing everybody.
I want to talk about Twitter. The Twitter IPO came out. Time Magazine says Twitter owes me
$42,000. $42,000?
By the way.
$22,000. What do you owe, Harper?
I don't even know what's going on anymore.
All right, so we'll go to the Twitter calculator and have a little fun with that. The number one person on
is probably owned a lot.
The number one person on Twitter is Katy Perry. Mm. Obama is owed millions. Katy Perry, I think, $7 million. Anyway, we'll do the calculation in just a bit. Our show today, I got some calculations for you. How much is your old iPhone worth? You want the new iPhone? You don't know. You could try to sell it online, or you could go to Gazelle.com, sell it to them. For top dollar, Gazelle is the fast and easy way to rid yourself of old gadgets. Believe me, I just went through, you know, a move, and I literally have a box, Chad. I'm bringing to work, and we're gonna get an intern to Gazelle everything. I'm gonna be a millionaire. Tablets, you got an old Microsoft Surface? Yeah, they'll actually buy a Surface tablet. I mean, I just got a curiosity. What is a 64 gig Surface RT? Worth. It's in good condition. I've got all the power supply and the touch type cover. $188. That's good. I'll take it. If you get an old iPhone or a Samsung, they'll even buy old Blackberries. That can't be worth anything. I'm not even going to look. That's
What's
too depressing.
Worth these days?
You want to know? Can't be worth anything. Which BlackBerry do you have?
I actually was given one as a promotion. I'm not allowed to take these things. So I was given one in promotion for some event.
That's perfect. You're allowed to sell it.
And I was like, I can't keep this. So I called my sister. I was like, do you want it? She's like, no. I called
my
mother-in-law. Do you want it? No. I literally could not give it away.
Yours probably looks like it's never been used. It's worth $87. But ethically, you can't sell it either.
You can't do anything.
You can only give it to somebody who won't take it. No. Who would want it?
Maybe Will Harris with two L's would want it.
Yeah. The bodybuilder. Yeah. You want that Z?
He looks like he's got thumbs that are going to be too big for that thing.
Gazelle, the iPhone, the iPad, the iPod. They'll buy Apple computers. They'll buy old tablets. They'll give you cash or a PayPal credit. Or, best thing to do, get the Amazon gift card. They bump it up 5%. They give you back the Amazon rebate. A million gadgets have been traded at Gazelle.com for over 700,000 customers, more than $100 million. They even pay the postage on anything worth more than a buck. So they'll send you a box with a prepaid mailer and everything. The offer that you get is good for 30 days. So let's say you know you're going to get an iPad mini, and we know it's out in November. We don't know when, but you should get the quote now, right? Because it's going to be worth more now than it's ever going to be worth again. That's true of any gadget. $255 for
really?
Yes.
Wow.
That gets you like halfway there to the next one. But get that quote now.
Great.
Lock it in for 30
days.
You gotta
lock it
gives
in.
You time to get the new iPad, get your data transferred off, all of that stuff. Gazelle.com.
Nice
work. Where is that stuff in your drawer? I swear to God, if it's the box this big, I cannot wait to find out what it's worth. But here's a good question. How much are you worth? Now, do you accept the premise, Nick? You just wrote the book, Hatching Twitter. Great book. Everybody must read it.
Do you want to read some of the reviews out loud?
A little later. We'll have a dramatic reading. Twitter, were you surprised, first of all, that Twitter, they asked for $27 in their initial public offering, ended up going up to, what, 46, 73% bump?
I think I was totally shocked. I mean, I knew that it was undervalued. I think that they, you know, they, I've spoken to a lot of the people involved, and they've all said they didn't want to make the mistake Facebook made, and they were going to go out. I mean, they knew that they were valued at around $16 to $20 billion.
This is tricky because if you start at too high a price,
correct.
You blow it.
Yep.
But if it's too low, then you miss out on the amount of the cash you could have gotten.
Well, but you also, not only that, I think that the thing that people aren't realizing is there was an incredible amount of excitement on the day of the IPO because they popped. There's a ceiling there.
Right.
And they had to go down. Now it's down. What's it down
so
now?
I think $41. So it's
but
dropped
it just looks
fast.
Red. It doesn't look good. It's, right. You know, it's like these ugly red numbers. 7.24% is down. So, you know, I think that it's got to stabilize. And I think the company is worth around $20 billion and not 25. So
it was valued at $27, I think at $18.5 billion, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah.
So Evan
you know,
Williams.
Here's,
the
here's what was crazy, right? So I was doing back-to-back interviews for my book the day of the IPO. And in the morning, I mean, I think I literally did 8 TV shows during the day.
Your timing is so good.
It was crazy.
Did you have inside information? How could you know when that?
I can't tell you that. Harper could tell you, but he might have to kill you.
You knew. You must have known. I mean, if you're going to do a book on Twitter, what's the best time to come out? 2 days before the Twitter IPO.
Well, that, so it was actually a day before because the
pricing
you
blew
was
it.
The day before.
You blew it.
I know.
One whole day.
No, but so here's what was really funny. So I was doing these interviews, and I think I started in the morning with the Today Show, the Canada, whatever they call that. I don't know what it's called. And they
today.
Were like, so what are these guys worth? And, you know, yeah, today.
Hey.
So they're like, what are these guys worth? And I explaining, like, what their valuations are. So Evan Williams was in the morning worth $1.1 billion, and Jack Dorsey was worth $500 million. By the end of the day, I did a Bloomberg special. Evan Williams had doubled and was worth $2.4 billion.
Your numbers up.
And Jack was worth $1.2 billion. I mean, literally in a day, it was wild to see that. So
now, it's on paper. I mean, they can't really capitalize
I mean,
on that.
Jack sold, I think, 0.6% of what he owned, I think, or something like that. Evan sold money before. He's already sold hundreds of millions of his stock before. But some of the other guys, I think most of them haven't sold much.
Ironically, Evan has started a new business, Medium.
Medium, which wrote about today.
Good article. But the point kind of is interesting that in both cases, he's making money on other people's work.
Well, actually,
right?
So in the book, I think the one thing that I found really fascinating writing the story about these guys was that Evan Williams from day one has always been about – it's never been about the money. The money had just came to him in every instance. He has always been about creating a place for everyone to have a voice. And there's a great anecdote in the beginning when they're running Blogger and Jason Goldman and all these other guys are in the room. And there were times that Ev and Blogger, they had no money, they had no lawyers or anything. And there were these people that were threatening to sue them and saying, you got to take this blog down, you got to do that. And Ev had this philosophy of push button publishing for the people, and he was adamant about it. And it was always, always about giving people a voice. And I still think that's the case.
And to be fair, he probably made enough money with the sale of Blogger to Google that he probably doesn't have to ever worry about money. So at this point, it's gravy.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, Medium
it's
is really
– he's like
he's not giving any of that gravy to the people who write for Medium. Very few people ever get paid for Medium,
that's
right?
That's true. That is true. He does pay
some people. I don't understand why people would write long-form articles to enrich Ev Williams.
Well, I think it's more – it's not just about enriching. I mean, what, you know, am I getting paid to come on here?
No.
Okay. So why am I here?
Well, but
because
I
have a book and I want to have a conversation with you and Harper and Will Smith with 1L and, you know,
Will Harris,
sorry.
1L, yeah.
So I think that the idea is that people want to tell stories and there's a place to do it and so
I just feel like if you had a blogger, you'd probably put it on your own blog. Wouldn't that be better?
Because
you own it.
Yes and no.
What's the advantage of Medium? I don't understand.
Harper, do you write posts for Medium?
I haven't written a post for anything since 2010 or something.
You've been lying
like
on
that.
The floor, remember?
It just honestly, Twitter really kind of killed my ability to blog.
I think that's
because
true.
I think I always had like two or three sentences in me, right. And then I just kind of blew them up and expanded them and said the same thing.
Of the tweet by Aaron Levy where he said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something along the lines of blogging was destroyed by Twitter, and soon Twitter will be destroyed by the fact that all we'll be able to do is communicate in shapes.
Instagram.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
It was really interesting that we talk a lot about the fact that Evan and Jack made an awful lot of money out of this, obviously. There was a great stat from NextWriter in the chat room saying that the Twitter IPO created over 1,600 millionaires in the Bay Area.
Wow. It's going to be really hard to get a table at the chicken restaurant. What's that called? State Preserves for Chickens.
Steak Chicken Preserve.
You know, anyway. Oh, look, so it would have been a good joke had I known the restaurant's name.
So do you want to hear the opening sentence of the book?
Let's hear it.
Let's hear it. You ready?
Do you want me to read it in a dramatic voice?
You read the first page in a dramatic.
In a dramatic voice, Hatching Twitter: The True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal by Nick Bilton. I'll skip the author's note as everybody else does.
Nick, who does the audiobook?
Some actor. I don't know his name. He's actually really
good. It's good.
Though.
It's very good.
He's really good. Yeah.
Audible.com.
Audible, and the guy. He's like a TV actor, and he's very dramatic. There's a lot of the word in the book, and I actually got to audition the actors, and I listened to the word over and over.
Really? You got to
see
audition.
Which
you
I like
to
the best.
Say it the best.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to bloop every one of
well,
those.
Well, you're really?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to say it in the beginning.
This is my audition, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, ready? Action.
Get out, Evan Williams said to the woman standing in his office doorway. I'm going to throw up. She stepped backward, pulling the door closed, a metal click sounding reverberating through the room as he grabbed the black wastebasket in the corner of his office, his hands now shaking and clammy. This is dramatic.
It's very dramatic.
Talk about in media race. You're starting right. This is like, wow. This was it. His last act. What? The story just began, and it's his last act as CEO of Twitter.
I know.
Would be throwing up into a garbage can. He knelt there for a moment, his dark jeans... How did you know he was wearing dark
jeans?
So
here's the most. This is the most fascinating thing to me, right? When I was writing this book,
yeah.
The story's amazing and the people
it's
and
incredible.
All this stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing, but you just skipped over the author's note. And the thing I describe in the author's note that was fascinating was all of these people had spent the last 7 years of their life tweeting,
right.
Putting pictures on Flickr, YouTube, everything.
It's all recorded.
They did. It was all recorded. I can describe literally. I mean, there are scenes in the book where I'm describing the weather because I can look it up online.
Wow.
I'm describing the chairs because I went and sat in the place that Jack checked in on Foursquare.
Wow.
I can say what he was eating because he tweeted a picture of it. I mean, it's literally it was. And that's
who was it said history began? You know, when the internet began, we are now recording everything.
And that for me was amazing. I mean, you could. I'm sure that any person that we know today, you could go and write a novel about them, even without interview. I mean,
right.
I spent hundreds of hours.
You talked
with these
to a
guys.
Lot of people,
yeah.
Right.
Spoke to all the founders.
I have a question about how you did this. Did you have some giant spreadsheet that was day by day with all of these kind of details in it?
I hired a friend of mine owns a company called Super Calendar, and it used to be called Superhuman, and it's a website where you could actually hire people to do tasks. And I hired his company to go and collect the first year of tweets from like the first 300 people.
Oh, smart.
And we put it into a database so I could search it.
That gave you your chronology.
That gave me the chronology.
Yeah.
And then I got access to thousands of emails and documents within Twitter that I could then cross-correlate them with. And then I actually created a workflowy document.
How did you get access? Was that Snowden?
Yeah, I had Snowden. He was working for me at the time. Yes.
Like these guys were completely willing to cooperate with
you. At first, they were not willing to cooperate with me. But eventually, once I got all this documentation and I could tell the story enough and I'd done it.
They knew who you were, that you talked to.
Well, that was why they didn't want to cooperate with me. They were scared that it was going to be a bit of a takedown or something. So,
did you have to reassure them that it wasn't going to be?
No, I just told them I was writing a book and if they wanted the truth out there.
Some of them do not.
Some of them do
look
not
look too good in this.
It is the truth, and sometimes the truth is.
Have you heard from any of them since?
Yes, I have.
Noah got screwed.
Noah got screwed. really, really, I feel really bad for Noah. He's a really, really sweet guy.
He was Ev Williams' neighbor.
He was Ev's neighbor. He was Jack Dorsey's best friend. Harper, did you ever meet Noah?
I never met Noah.
Will Smith with an L. Did you ever meet him?
Just so unless he flew to London, I'm going to say yeah. I'm going to say no on that.
No, Noah's like this super sweet guy who
founder at Odeo at Obvious,
yeah,
right?
He founded Obvious. This is a
came
great,
up with the name Twitter, and I resent him forever for that.
Yeah, he came up with he invented the name Twitter, and he was thrust out of the company. Unfairly.
He basically was written out of in some sort of
history.
Soviet purge, written out of the history of Twitter.
Yeah, so this is.
Is he the Eduardo Saverin? He is the Twitter.
He's the Eduardo Saverin, but Eduardo ended up with $2 billion. Noah ended up with nothing.
he had no stock.
I don't want to give away the book because it's written like a murder mystery. And right. I want to, you know, you got to actually get through.
But Leo, talking to people who ended up with nothing at this.
Wow.
As the top person on Twitter in 2008.
I have that article here. Leo Laporte is now the top tweeter. This is from The Guardian. Will the Twitter microblogging service soon be dominated by mainstream media? So it's Leo Laporte, number one, with 32,000 followers.
Wow.
Then Kevin Rose coming. This was when we were in a race to the
top.
Wait,
how did you have 32,000 back then? Were you just very early on?
This is why I should get some money from Twitter, because I was not only there early in December 2006, but I promoted the hell out of it. Big mistake on my part.
Let's make some phone calls right now and get
Kevin Rose, then Barack Obama, candidate Barack Obama. This was before Harper joined the campaign and put him
much
to the,
before.
Yeah, put him to the top. Then Jason Calacanis, Robert Scoble, Veronica Belmont, Alex. It was dominated by tech TV person Merlin Mann, Mike Arrington. It was the geek averse, and then Ashton Kutcher came along, and the whole thing went to hell in a handbasket.
Well, he tried to buy the company.
Did he really?
Yeah, it's in the book. There's a great scene where Evan Williams and Biz Stone go down to his. They fly them down to.
How much
to
did
his
he
pool.
Offer them?
Well, he was like, look, I'll tweet and you'll give me some equity for tweeting and I'll bring all my celebrities' friends. But that they were down by the pool and Demi Moore was laying there in a bikini and it was pretty dramatic and exciting. And
Hollywood. They got kind of seduced by it, didn't they?
Did who? The Hollywood folks?
No, the Twitter folks.
No, they didn't.
They didn't.
No.
They didn't get sucked
Jack,
in.
Jack got seduced by the Hollywood stuff, but Ev didn't. Ev and Biz did not.
Yeah.
The only time that Biz ever got seduced was there's a scene where Al Gore tries to buy the company, and he invites them over to his place in the St. Regis, and he gets them totally drunk. And there's this great scene where he's trying to convince him to sell him part of Twitter and create this thing called Twitter TV. Goes into the bathroom, he goes into the kitchen, and he comes out with a bottle of Patron.
Biz does.
No, Al Gore,
Gore does. Yeah.
Former president. He comes out with a bottle of Patron, and he says, "I hear this is the good stuff." And then they do shots.
Shots of tequila. That's how I work.
Wait. So getting back to Twitter, did you guys all think that? No, not the book. I'm talking about the company. Did you guys all think that the stock was going to do this well?
I mean, here's a company that's never had a profit,
correct?
Right? And hasn't really shown a clear path to profit.
Well, $600 million in revenue this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
$1 billion next year.
Yeah.
Harper's on it.
How did they make $600 million?
They'll make $600 million in revenue. Sponsored tweets, sponsored
trending,
accounts where
trending.
People pay to get new. Sponsored search.
I of course knew. I thought it would be bumped like this because people love this stuff. But I do think it's a kind of. I don't give stock advice, so please don't take my stock advice. I don't invest in tech stocks, so obviously I know nothing. It seems to me that it's difficult for Twitter to monetize without ruining what it is that makes Twitter. Popular.
Well, that's the thing that I worry about. I mean, the thing that separates Twitter, I think, from all these other companies, especially Facebook, is that they have always taken pride in caring for the user and being careful of their privacy. And I wonder if they can continue to do that as a public company.
So let's see. Now, Twitter raised... This is... Time Magazine did this. I think this is kind of a... makes sense. Basically, according to the IPO paperwork... 230 million active users.
I think it's 245 now.
Oh, right. You can change that. But anyway,
okay.
Roughly. We'll be conservative. We're going to use conservative numbers here, okay?
That works for me.
So it's going to be at least this much.
Yep.
500 million tweets a day. Twitter says we deliver more than 200 billion tweets a day to our users. That means an average of 400 people see each tweet. $24.5 billion value. Now it's gone down a little bit. divided by 200 billion tweet deliveries. That's 12.45 cents per daily eyeball. That's the number we're going to use here.
Okay.
All right. Now, all right, Harper Reed, you're at Harper Reed, right?
I'm just at Harper.
At Harper. Ooh. Early adopter. The first Harper.
The first. I'm very
35,000 tweets. You've been on Twitter 2,674 days. You should get out of this $10,000.
What? Only 10,000 for 35,000 tweets?
You're Nick Bilton, right? Nick Bilton. Let's just see how much you get for.
But I only have 7,500 tweets. How am I getting paid more money than Harper, who has clearly put more effort and
more
attention?
Followers. It's all down to the followers.
It's almost as if it's kind of made up for the sake of publicity.
No. This is math.
Let's try Will over here.
Let's do Will with one L Smith. I know it's Harris. But from now on, he's Will with one L Smith.
Will Harris, you only get $1,758.
Oh, I'll take that. You know what? On a pro rata population basis, I think I'm probably doing okay.
Some people, like we did this with my call screener on the radio show, her Twitter handle, HBomb. She gets nothing.
What is the URL for this?
I misspelled it.
Some people are asking for
it. Well, it's a long URL. Just to search for Time Magazine. How much does Twitter owe me? Something like that.
Time Magazine.
Time and how much does Twitter owe me? HBALM. She's got $3. That's nothing.
All right. Let's see what Twitter owes.
How about Justin Bieber?
Ooh.
The Biebs. Whoops. I don't want to follow Justin Bieber, so stop it.
I don't even know how to spell that.
I clicked the link and now I'm now we've broken Time Magazine. Oh, you people, everybody's doing it. Now I can't do it anymore.
We're talking of complete disasters on that.
$20 million, Justin Bieber's.
$20 million?
Barack Obama, $5 million. But that's based on the notion that your tweets are what make Twitter valuable.
Wow.
But that's
I agree.
BS, right?
I mean, I completely agree with that. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that?
That's my dog. Oh. Wait a minute. He has actually the real Ozzy. I wonder what my dog is owed. Ozzy, guess what? Nothing.
He needs to tweet more.
Twitter owes you nothing. You need to tweet more. He's only got one tweet.
I know.
That's the problem.
If he were to tweet more, he might really have a real income.
It's the only place in the world a dog can make money tweeting.
I'm still shocked that Harper only makes 10 grand.
He says that Harper should get a portion of Obama's.
This is why I don't think this is real. Because if this was real, I would get at least 10 or 20 million. Right? I mean, this makes sense.
So here's the interesting name that came up today on Bloomberg, Chris Sacca.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Chris Sacca, who was at Google and is a well-known kind of angel investor, right? Uh-huh. Early stage investor.
He gets $490,000.
He is the largest outside investor in Twitter.
His consortium. It's not his money. It's Rizvi and all those other guys.
Yeah. So apparently what Chris did is put together some companies with very obscure names like Institutional Associates Fund LLC and Compliance Matters Services LLC and started buying up Twitter stock before the IPO. From Twitter insiders. He's been doing it for the last few years. He's actually raised money to buy shares in Twitter from vested employees and early investors. And apparently he now has his company, Rizvi Traverse, has a 17.9% stake in Twitter.
Wow.
Worth a lot of money.
Yes. Yeah, it's worth a lot of money.
A lot of money.
17% stake is a couple of billion bucks.
Yeah.
$4 billion?
Smart move.
$4 billion.
Smart move.
Not bad.
And what's interesting about and also he used JP Morgan.
So did you buy any stock?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I told you I don't buy any. I don't buy tech stock on principle.
I'm principal.
Did you? Do you have
I'm not food? Allowed to.
You also work for a journalistic enterprise.
When I first started as a reporter at the New York Times 4 years ago, I worked at the Times for 8 years. When I started 4 years ago, I owned like $15,000 in Apple stock, and they made me sell
it. Divest it, yeah.
And
it would be worth how much today?
Well, in the high, it would have been worth like hundreds of thousands. I don't know. But
you could have gotten out of this race.
Yeah, I could have. Yeah.
So to be fair, I did have stock in Will Harris's channel Flip. Because you gifted it to me one day, and I just it arrived in the mail, and it made me a little bit of money when you sold it. So thank you. Thank you.
So, did you guys buy any stock, or are you not allowed to either?
Well, you could.
Yeah, I could have done, but I didn't. I thought, you know, there's always an interesting a great phenomenon with tech companies or companies like that, the IPO, where people use them. And people who could buy shares in them actually use them every day. And it was one of the reasons people said the Facebook thing was massively overpriced and oversubscribed, because people understand it and they sort of understand, you know, it's like, I use it every day. It's really great. I really enjoy Facebook, so I'm going to buy it. And I think the same is probably true with Twitter. But I think, you know, people have talked, we talked a little bit about the fact that, you know, is Twitter really worth that amount of money? How are they making money, et cetera? And can they do it without completely ruining the user experience? And I think a lot of people said about Facebook, you know, even a year ago or 18 months ago, can Facebook make money from mobile without completely ruining the mobile user experience? And I think if you look at their, you know, performance over the last few months, they're clearly making a ton of money from mobile now. Well, I haven't really seen a drop off in terms of people actually using the mobile platform, right?
Well, you're seeing a drop off with teens. There was a Pew Research report last week that said that teens are leaving Facebook in lieu of Instagram and Twitter. And then there was
Vine. Don't forget Vine, but that's
Vine,
Twitter also.
And Twitter. And there also was a Piper Jaffray report that said the same thing. And the numbers for all of these services are declining in Facebook and going up for teens in Twitter. So maybe that is because the mobile service is not that great.
I also think that there's no lock-in, really, in the long run. I mean, or is that the case? I mean,
I think
that because of MySpace immediately losing to Facebook as soon as Facebook came along. It feels as if any of this is very fluid. It could change at any time.
That's the hard part. You know, I was talking to a friend in Hollywood. We were just talking about movie stuff, like, related to the book, and he said that he actually saw a script very early on for a MySpace movie. And it's like, thank God he didn't get into that. I mean, it's literally how do you know, these things just change so very quickly. But I do think that some of them are here to stay. I don't know what Facebook will be in the future. I mean, it could just be a really glorified address book, but it will still be here.
Do you think so?
So Leo, I think the final note on the how much does Twitter owe you has to go to the fact that someone in the chat room pointed out that $108,000 for horse ebooks. I think that sums it up.
You know the horse ebooks account.
Oh, yeah.
This is the it's a spam account.
That's funny.
It's a spam account. The funniest account in the world. A lot of people follow him because it's completely non sequitur. And then, except apparently, every once in a while, they post a link to something they're selling.
Well, it's done now, right? I mean, it came out as BuzzFeed?
It was Susan Orlean of The New Yorker found the people who were responsible for it, and then it quit, right?
Oh, really? Well, the last tweet is September
24th. Yeah, that was 24th. When Susan found the horse.
So why'd they stop?
I never actually understood it.
Well, it turns out that it was actually a BuzzFeed employee.
It wasn't real? It wasn't
I don't think it was real.
An art project.
And it wasn't a real horse.
This is one of those days when I wake up and I go to Twitter and I missed some really important piece of information and I have no idea what's happening, but all of my friends were just devastated that horse ebooks wasn't real, and I just had no idea what they were talking about. So they're just saying, like, I can't believe it's not real, and I'm just like, what are we talking about?
Susan Orlean, horse ebooks is human after all.
So sad, right?
Oh, well, you know, I just assumed, because if you look at it, every once in a while there's a link in there to buy something, and I just assumed this was a spam account, right? The idea is somehow, and I've never really understood how Twitter spam works anyway, right? Because maybe you can explain this, Nick.
How it works?
Yeah, I mean, it's estimated, widely estimated, that the number of phony accounts on Twitter is at least half, right?
Oh, it's maybe as much as
three quarters.
Well, so they actually did a big cleanup before the S1, and they had to because otherwise they would have gotten in trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission. But they actually eliminated tens of millions of accounts in that cleanup. But the thing that's really interesting, if you go to like Fiverr.com, you can purchase 7,000 followers for $5.
Right.
And they're bots.
Right. So I understand follower count.
Okay.
Because if you're a Hollywood celebrity, in fact, we know it improves your value to Hollywood. You can in your contract say, yes, and I have 3 million followers and I will promote the movie. And that actually adds value to you as a star, right?
If you're Justin Bieber with 45 million followers, and you know, you could probably imagine purchasing more accounts so you can beat Kate. Is it Katy Perry who's the number one?
Katy Perry's number one right now.
Number one.
Number one.
I was number one, but they were all real when I was in my day. They were, yeah, they real, were real people. They were 32,000 of them. But I still don't understand. I can understand follower counts. So I understand why Fiverr works, because they're going to create phony accounts so that you can inflate your follower count. Yep. But spam has existed on Twitter for a long time. And I don't quite understand how that's supposed to work, because you're not going to follow a spammer.
No, but so you, are you asking why they do it or how they do it?
I understand how they do it. Why do they do it?
They do it because they want you to click on the picture.
But I don't see it because I don't follow. How do they get the people to follow them?
Well, no, they don't. I mean,
because they have
one way
pictures of really pretty girls as their avatars.
Exactly. They use pretty girls as the avatar.
There's a great theory, which is which I heard somewhere listening to on the radio the other day, maybe it was on NPR, which was why is it that Nigerian spam emails are still so really obviously Nigerian spam emails, right? Like, there's no attempt to discover them.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
Because
they're still Nigerian princes.
What you want to be able to do is to trick the most gullible of people. And if people are a little bit gullible, right, then they will see the Nigerian spam email and go, oh, it's a Nigerian spam email. You want the people who see the Nigerian spam email and go, oh, my word, there is a prince in Nigeria that really needs my help. Those are the people that you want, because those are the people.
They're
that
really dumb.
It's exactly.
So you have Twitter and you put a picture of a pretty girl in a bikini and she says, hey, I really like your tweet, follow me back or whatever. And you go, oh my God, this really hot girl likes my tweets. I better do what she asks me.
And plus, a lot of people don't have a lot of followers, and if someone follows them and they're a pretty girl,
they'll follow back.
Or they look like Harper, they'll follow back. And
I'm a good looking man. And I'm a great looking man.
Somebody said before that you look like Jesse Pinkman in the chat room.
The late Jesse Pinkman. Not the early Jesse Pinkman.
So and then the other spam is they use the API.
I didn't mean late as in dead. I mean later as in, oh. Yeah, see, if you hadn't said spoiler, it would have gone, but no, now.
Wait, well, everybody I haven't knows. Even seen that. Was that a spoiler? I haven't even seen it.
Wait, you haven't seen what? Breaking Bad?
Anything.
I've never seen it.
Goodness.
Not seen anything. Forget it.
Wait, there's no such thing as spoiling Breaking Bad at this point. The show's been over for...
No! I beg to differ. I've seen it. You've seen it. But I got to tell you, if you said anything in the chat room, would harass you mercilessly.
I think the chat room's harassing
me
already. If I say the word book, I'm a bad human being.
Dumbledore was killed by...
That got me. I logged on to the General Mayhem forum or something, and like the top sticky was the Snape Dumbledore scenario.
This guy? Yeah. British.
Oh, he's British. Okay. We're gonna take a back break.
Wait, real quick, the best way that the spammers work on Twitter is DMs. They direct message you.
Really?
And they're like, oh my God, check this out. And because they use APIs and all those fun things, and you're like, I have to check it out, and you click, and next thing you know, you have, I don't know what they take, where they take you, but
oh, I could tell you because I got one. But the thing is, these are hacked accounts, I think. So I'll get a hack.
Where did they take you?
A friend's hacked account. Look here, these are people I know. These are links to. Don't show it because I don't want people to go there. But these are links to .ru. You know, to dangerous sites. And these are coming in my direct message.
And then do they take over your computer and make you part
of
the NSA?
Well, one of them went to TVVITTER.com, and it looked like a full-on Twitter login page. And obviously they were trying to get my credentials so they could continue to do this.
Should I go there and check it out?
No, I think it's down now.
Down for everyone?
I think, in fact, when I went there, I got a Google warning. This is a fraudulent site. But I get a lot of, in my direct messages from people I know who've obviously been hacked... that kind of, you know, spammy sites are more likely malware sites.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's another fine mess you've gotten us into, Twitter.
Twitter.
Did you ever ask them why they, I remember I talked to Ev early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ev, you know, you were running Odeo. You must have heard of the podcast Twit and known that we had the name Twit and the trademark Twit. Did you ever consider that? He literally told me, no, because when we named it Twitter, we didn't think either of us was going anywhere. So, big deal, right?
Well, it was first Twitter without vowels, too, so T-W-T-T-R.
Yeah, right. And that was Noah Glass that came up with it.
That was Noah Glass.
You tell the story. I've only read the excerpt, not the whole book, because I just got the book, thanks to you.
Yeah.
But in the excerpt, you tell the story of him actually paging through a dictionary.
He was paging through for like 3 days. Everyone said he was paging through a dictionary.
It.
And he And he had this moment.
First, they proposed friendstalker.com.
There was Friendstalker, which was Ev's idea. Then there was Biz Stone wanted to call it SMSE, SMSSY.
That sounds like dangerous.
That's not in the book. But
no,
that's
SME.
And then there was some other names. There were other projects that they were thinking of melding together. One was called Ketchup. So it could have been called Ketchup.
It's a condiment.
And then there was another one that was similar to Friendstalker. And then... and then Jack wanted to call it Status, and there were all these different things. And there was Jitter. Somebody actually in the chat room just mentioned that. Very good.
That was Noah Glass's first attempt, I think, was Jitter.
So what happened was, Noah's sitting at his – he went home because he couldn't concentrate. He's sitting at his desk, and he's going through this dictionary, and his phone keeps going ding, ding, ding. And he gets really annoyed, and he goes over, and he reaches over, and he turns it off, and it vibrates. And he looks up the word vibrate.
Right.
And then – and he's like, oh, this could be really it. And he's like, oh, vibrate doesn't sound very good. And he looks up the word similar to it, and he ends up with the word twitch. And then four or five words later, there was Twitter. And it all made sense. And then he thought to himself, wait, doesn't Leo Lepore have a show
right
that,
twit. Yeah.
that he's
apparently
doing?
Not.
Apparently not.
Apparently they didn't think of that. Even though they must have known. Odeo.
But I think the Twitter part of the reason it's so successful is because of that name.
Oh, God, you're killing me now.
You don't think so?
Yes, of course it is.
Harper agrees.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely a name for having just sat there and thought of that. I think Vibrator with an R on the end should be a social network of some sort.
That was a penetrating comment. Thank you very much, Will, with one L Smith. We're going to take a break. The book is prominently displayed on the screen.
You should get some money. You should actually get some money because you have four letters of their name.
I should get some money from Penguin because I've got your book prominently displayed on my... That doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way.
What doesn't?
Promotion is just free. It's just... we don't get money for it. We just do it. Our show today brought... but you do get money for what I'm about to do.
What are you about
God
to do?
God forgive me. We are brought to you today by Stamps.com. When's the last time you went to the post office? A great experience.
I want to go to Stamps.com.
Oh, you do want to go to Stamps.com. Actually, if you were, for instance, mailing books to friends and family, you might have a lot of mailing to do. And this time of year, you go to the post office, a stack of books, media mail in your arm. You go there, there's 100 other people ahead of you mailing, you know... how much is a stamp today?
How much does a stamp cost?
No one knows. You don't have to know because Stamps.com does it all for you. You don't have to get up from your desk. You've got a USB scale. You plop the book right on there in the media mailer. It even says, is this a book? It should be media mail.
Really?
Give you the different rates. Absolutely.
Wait, I can buy this now?
You don't have to buy anything. I'm going to set you up here.
You don't have to buy the scale?
You don't have to. Well, you get pay shipping and handling. It's $5. You can afford that, right? This book's got to make you $100 easy. So here's the deal. Go to Stamps.com. This is... buy, print, you don't need a postage meter. Did you know this is a good stat? Postage meter ink is 100 times more expensive than inkjet ink, which is already outrageously expensive. It's crazy.
Blow my mind.
Crazy. So you don't need that. You can use your regular printer, your regular computer. We use it here. We'll print stamps. You can buy, labels that you put it right onto. These are legal U.S. postage. You can also print right on an envelope with your logo. The return address is auto-filled in, so is the address you're sending it to. Stamps.com. Rick Billington, one of our listeners, is a real estate broker. He owns his own company. He heard about us talking about it. He used to take postage, his envelopes and packages to the post office. He said out-of-date scales he'd purchased at an office supply store. So it would say a price, and then he'd have to add 4 cents or whatever. He said it was a hassle and a waste of time. He loves the convenience of Stamps.com. He always gets exactly the right postage. He doesn't overpay just to, make sure you don't get postage due. And he never runs out of postage when he needs it for the business. I want you to try it today. Go to Stamps.com. Don't click. Do you see that $80 value? You're probably saying, I'm going to go for that. No, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Type in TWIT as the promo code. And that $80 value turns to a $110 bonus offer. You get the scale. The digital scale, you get a $5 supply kit. You get $55 in free postage to use over the first few months of your account. And, of course, a 4-week trial. Stamps.com. Will's run out to the post office. He thought he'd have some time. Stamps.com. Use our code TWIT, if you will, to let everyone know about Stamps.com.
I am actually going to try Stamps.com.
You don't have to.
No, I really am. It looks really cool.
Do you mail a lot of stuff?
Well, I don't because I don't have the patience to go to the post office.
It's better for a small business than like an individual. I mean, if you mail a postcard once in a while, it's not going to be really worth your time.
Well, I think it's important to mail mail things certain.
Well, I'll things. Tell you one thing. You know, when you mail, so this book's probably more than 13 ounces when you put it in the package. When you mail a package that is more than 13 ounces, you have to bring it to the, normally you have to bring it to the post office so they can look you in the eye.
Yeah.
You look scruffy. You look dangerous. We're going to open this up. But with stamps.com, because there's an indicia on it that says, it identifies it exactly, uh-huh. a barcode.
Yeah.
You can mail any size package.
Wow.
Anytime. You don't have to go to the post. You never have to go to the post office. And that was not in the ad.
Interesting.
Well, actually, it was. You put the lower third back up, didn't you? Stamps.com. Will's back.
We lost Will for a second.
He's back.
Sorry, I had to grab a power adapter.
Let's see. Where is everyone in the chat room?
So Nick Bilton's having fun with the chat room. That's nice.
From.
Harper Reed, do you have a job?
Yes.
Do you have a job? I've wondered about that too.
I do have a job. I have a small company here in Chicago.
What are you doing?
We're building e-commerce software for businesses.
Would you ever work in politics again?
I don't think I would work in politics again. However, it's just really hard. It's like a lot of work. A lot of politics with a little P, a lot of no sleep.
Yeah.
But the thing that's exciting is it's this incredibly valuable experience. Like it's the most exciting and valuable thing I've ever done. Or like, valuable is the wrong word. Rewarding maybe is a better word. Rewarding experience. But at the same time, like, you know, you wake up and you just kind of dread going in because you never know what's going to happen. You don't know what the news cycle is going to bring.
Right.
You're just banging your head against a wall.
Is it better or worse than working at a startup where you have long hours?
Well, usually, I don't know. I found it's similar.
Right.
However, it's so high pressure. Startups are high pressure as well. But at a startup, if you know, the four of us were doing a startup and, you know, after the show was our launch, we could all go on a vacation for a week.
Right.
You don't have that opportunity. And then also you're also working for this hope that you make some money, and there's not that opportunity either, and no one does it for the money, so it's, you can't really compare those.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's the opportunity to change the world, right? Or one, right. I'm sure one must feel that way.
Yes, and you definitely look at it as, especially when you're comparing the other side, like what could happen, you're thinking, I am saving the world. This is my chance to participate in a very small way to really save the world.
Make
and that's you cannot find anything else that's like that. And it's actually interesting because right now we're starting this company and we've been going for a few months now.
What is the company?
And it's called Lunar Technology, and we're in the middle of a rebranding, so we'll have more later. But we're very quiet, specifically just because we just don't have a product to show yet. But we're just building and building and building. But
it's like we're very quiet. We're just announcing it on Twit right now.
I was like, gotta go. but it's a very small company, and we leave it like 6. You know, sometimes you're there till 6:30, and the first couple days you kind of feel guilty because at the campaign we worked so late and we worked so hard. And I'll come home and I'll forget to check email for a few hours, and once again I have this like guilt because for 2 years. My constant companion was my phone with my email, and was interacting and trying to, you know, negotiate various things in the middle of the night, and just there's no off. Whereas even my friends who are involved with very successful, very high pressure startups, they have some opportunities for off.
Right.
And that's, I think, one of the big differences. There was just no chance for off, but that was part of the deal, right?
Did you have moments where you were, you know, it was 4 a.m. and your little red iPhone rang and they were like, "We need you in the White House now."
So one of my favorites was, it wasn't 4 a.m, but it was quite late, and it was during, I think it was during one of the convention nights, and I think the president had just finished speaking, and we got. I'm like kind of watching my email, and it turns out that YouTube's algorithms had marked the stream as spam or had having.
Really?
No, I don't think it was spam. I think that they had some licensed music, so it just turned off the stream.
Yeah, they do that to us all the time. Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, and of course, I'm just like, what the f- like, what do we do? And so, you know, of course,
Harper,
I get on the
you
phone
know
with,
the guys at YouTube, call them.
That's basically right? it. And so I reach out to our, you know, to our kind of, because all the big companies have what they call government or politics right. people that you reach out to. So you reach out to those guys and then they reach out. And it was fun because it was just, you start out with some, like the person that's up, and eventually you're on this thread with everyone in the world where they're just like, we have to fix this. And I'm on the phone with them and I'm just like, I don't care if it's automated, just unautomate it, make it so it goes, you know. And that type of thing happened all the time. We spent a lot of time, I mean, just so much time making sure that there weren't surprises, because that's really the worst thing that can happen in this world, where your number one enemy is the message and deviating from that message.
So I have a question. When you finally said goodbye to that world, what was the first thing that you did? Did you go to Disneyland? Did you eat a hamburger? Did you lay on your floor and you just woke up? What?
I thought about this a lot. My wife was like, you have got to leave something, go somewhere weird and just hang out by yourself for a little while. You're driving me crazy.
He's like, I'm going on Twit.
So I did go on Twit.
Yes.
Right after. I asked some friends. I said, I need to go somewhere I don't know anyone. And a good friend of mine was like, why don't you go to San Diego? And I was like, oh, okay.
Don't know anyone there.
So I went to San Diego for a week and just hung out at some weird resort that it was totally off season. No one was there. It was me and the hotel bartender. And then I read a bunch of books. And
sounds
I didn't.
Awesome.
I didn't bring a phone.
What did you read? Can you tell us some of the books you read?
Yeah, I actually read. I think the best one. Let me see if I can get his name right. Some really great World War II, history books. You know, Anthony Beaver.
Sounds like a good time to me, huh, Leo?
Mm-hmm. Great party.
The Fall of Stalingrad was the book I read, one of them.
Oh, such a good
book. Okay, yes.
Who could forget the end of that?
Yes.
Stalingrad Falls. Yeah. It's amazing.
Did you like the part where Stalin met Grad?
Kind of sad, actually.
No, really. It is. It's terrible, yeah. There's a great new history of World War II that, because of all the Russian stuff that's been released since the fall of the Soviet Union, called The Storm of War, that's really interesting. It's the first time we hear a lot of the Russian side of this.
So I'm trying to think what else I read. I read, Robot Apocalypse, some sci-fi book. I read, what is it? A Confederacy of Dunces.
Ah, oh, classic.
Which drove me crazy. I was just like, this
book
is, it just made me so mad. Mm. In retrospect, I think back on it and I think about like,
why did
my
it make you mad?
Oh, that character. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm sitting there by
it's
myself.
So annoying.
I have no one to talk to. I'm in a hotel bar. I'm talking to the bartender.
I'm in San Diego.
In San Diego. The only time he read any books was when he read The Jungle by Upton St. Clair or whatever, in prison. That seems like he's like, I don't read this book. I did read The Jungle once in prison.
I'm the just bartender?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, the bartender. He was really nice. And so we're, you know,
he's in prison and he's reading the expose of the meatpacking industry from the 20s. That's what he's talking about?
Yeah. Who am I going to complain about that dunce guy that drove everyone crazy? He made me so mad.
So funny.
So that was it. So I just kind of had to lay it.
Will Harris, have you ever been? Have you? You look kind of bored. Have you ever been to San Diego?
I was just thinking, if only there was some sort of huge NSA leak that we could talk about.
Let's talk about it. It pissed off Google.
I think Harper in San Diego is quite fun.
Actually, I'm interested because Harper does have on his page his PGP key. And, of course, we know that if you use PGP or Tor or any attempt to hide your identity or to encrypt your mail, that the NSA has deemed that you are worthy of collecting your email. Do you use PGP?
I do. I've used it for years and years and years, and I think it's obviously very important. It's also hard as heck to use.
Yeah, it's very
I don't know
hard.
How anyone really uses it.
Good. I'll send you my key. You send me yours, and then our mail will be encrypted. And then someday, 20 years from now, when the NSA decrypts it, it'll be so bored. We could talk about Upton Sinclair.
Yeah, exactly.
Fabulous.
Exactly. Exactly. I never use it for anything important.
Well, the NSA, this is, you know, again, another one of the Edward Snowden leaks. It is in this case, a post-it note with a smiley face on it.
What
oh, yeah, that.
Yeah. of all the leaks that you see, like a post-it note with a smiley, is pretty high
but,
up there.
But this, of all the slides, I think most pissed off Google. The picture is... I don't think it's a PowerPoint slide. I really think that this is a
I think it's a
post-it note.
It is a post-it note. You can tell from the edge on the bottom left. It looks like it's a photo of a post-it note.
So it's two clouds, the public internet, the Google cloud, and in between the two, there is this thing called a GFE, a Google front-end server. Mm-hmm. And what it points out, and in fact, these are the replication servers for Google all over the globe. Of course, Google has to maintain multiple servers all over the globe. In order for the Google Mail and everything else to appear to everybody, you have to replicate. And in the replication, at least at this time, it was unencrypted. In fact, there's a little smiley face where it says, this is weird. I just think of some spy drawing this little happy face here. SSL added and removed here. And then they're pointing to the Google front-end server. When showed this, Eric Schmidt said, outrageous, but the two Google engineers, Brandon Downey, the first, basically responded with profanity. I guess since we've already used the F-bomb on this show, you're already going to be bleeping. He said, F these guys. I've spent the last 10 years of my life trying to keep Google's users safe and secure from the many diverse threats Google faces. He says, I've seen armies of machines DDoSing Google. I've seen worms. I've seen spyware. I've even seen oppressive governments use state-sponsored hacking to target dissidents. But even though we suspected this was happening, it still makes me terribly sad. It makes me sad because I believe in America. But after spending all that time helping in my tiny way to protect Google, it's just a little like coming home from the war with Sauron. Destroying, get this. This is a geek metaphor if ever there was one. Destroying the One Ring only to discover the NSA is on the front porch of the Shire, chopping down the party tree and outsourcing all the Harbit farmers with half-orcs and whips. The U.S. has to be better than this. But I guess in the interim, that security job is looking a lot more like the Sisyphus thing than ever.
Wow.
Very upset. Wow. And two Google engineers wrote about this, and both using the same profane expression. They were miffed.
Did Google these posts, do you think? Or
so I think they make it pretty clear in the post, like, this is not the opinion of my employer.
Here's the Mike Kern
likewise
post.
Well, but if Google didn't feel like this was a legitimate way of approaching this, I think they would be straight on to them to say, you know, you need to take this down. I think what was interesting though about the first post from
Mike Kern.
Brandon Downey,
because
he was like, we suspected that they were doing this, but it's good to, you know, but it's good to find out. And you think,
isn't that the case? We all did suspect this.
We suspected they were doing it. Well, of course, Steve Gibson suspected this from day one. He was like, they've got a tap on the actual fiber cables, and this is what he said back in the day, right?
And what Google's response has been is, of course, to encrypt now that all the traffic between the replicating servers. And I think they're really actively trying to defeat this kind of spying. Mike Kern's a Brit, and he says the GHCQ is even worse.
It's interesting because we've had a GCHQ in the UK is sort of like the sort of UK equivalent, I guess, of the NSA in some ways. And because of the, I guess, the sort of Irish troubles and things in the 80s, it's sort of been common knowledge that in the UK, if you use, you know, the regular telephone system, GCHQ does keyword monitoring just across the board. And so we've had sort of not quite the same expectation of privacy, certainly for phone calls, right, in the UK, because we've sort of had that history of domestic terrorism, I guess. But certainly I think everybody expected the internet to be a different scenario. And it turns out that, of course, it's not. And that in many cases, because Britain has slightly easier laws in terms of getting around public speech because of that history, you know, the NSA has been working on projects with GCHQ to get things done over here that it couldn't get done in the US, which seems to be a subversion of sort of, you know, the point of it, even if not the legality of it.
Hearn said, we designed the system to keep criminals out. There's no ambiguity here. And bypassing that system is illegal for a good reason.
Yeah.
I have a question
yeah.
for the audience. or the attendees or whatever these people are, the people here.
This live studio audience?
To everyone. So here's my question. There's if we could go back in time and have this kind of system that existed and hypothetically stop something like 9/11 from happening, I would be personally willing to give up my freedom, if you will, on the internet or whatever these devices are that we use to avoid a catastrophe like that. So,
but it's a false dichotomy, Nick. There's no proof that A would ever happen. Theoretically, do I want to save thousands of lives?
Question, though. I think, and something that doesn't often get asked is, and I think that in fact we gave them permission and encouraged them to. Dan Gere, who's a security expert, gave a great talk, which he's published on his gear.tinho.net website, in which he basically says, as soon as you say, as we did in 2001, never again,
yep,
then you have to have the kind of surveillance that we're talking about here.
Yes.
In effect,
yes,
by saying this may not happen again, you have to say, well, then we have to have total information awareness. There's no logical alternative to that.
And what is your viewpoint on it?
Well, I mean, Ben Franklin said quite famously, those who would trade, what did he say? Those who would trade privacy for security deserve neither, in effect.
Deserve neither and will get neither.
And
right?
And so it seems to me there has to be a balance.
Well, I agree.
There is the very real question of how much terrorism has been stopped by this kind of surveillance. But yes. I don't think you can blame the NSA, because I think the NSA feels rightly they were instructed to do this. Mm-hmm. That they, in effect, were said, starting with George W. Bush, went to the NSA, said, this may not happen again, do what it takes. And in the NSA's opinion, and I think they're probably right, if you want total safety, you have to have total information. And
well, I think there's an interesting point, which is, in that circumstance, does what they're doing have to be legal?
Well, yes, and that's the point.
I would say it is legal. That's why we passed the Patriot Act. That's why we have the FISC rules, the FISA court. It is legal. Whether it's right, whether it's even constitutional, has never been decided by a court. But it is legal.
Unconstitutional is illegal, right? Because if you're breaking the Constitution,
But it's not been ruled unconstitutional yet. It's not been challenged in court, right?
It is currently. Seemingly legal, I think, is what you're getting at.
I think the Patriot Act says it's legal.
And I think that what Will's talking about is that the rules are definitely very different in the UK, right?
Yeah, for sure. But I think there is an I think it's interesting because there is an expectation that if you are, if you're in that kind of service, you still have to play by the rules of legality. Otherwise, you could literally just do anything. But yeah. I think there's a really genuine, a good question, which you point out, Leo, which is, no one has yet ruled this unconstitutional. So in the absence of that, it sort of is by default presumed to be. But I think what this is doing is, to your point, Nick, opening a real conversation.
Which nobody's had in the last
10 years.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly why I asked that question. I'm not saying one thing or the other works or doesn't. But I grew up in England, up north in Leeds. And during the IRA, and I remember being in Manchester when there was bombings. Oh, I remember my sister being there. I remember being at the embassy one day in London, and there was a bomb outside, and they had to shut the whole place down. And it was, as a kid, it was scary. And we haven't had that in America yet. But do we just want to say, well, let's just hope that doesn't happen? Don't we want to be somewhat proactive?
Well, there's something else that we're really addressing, which is that legislation and technology are not hand in hand. And so there's a great book called Exploding the Phone, talking about big phone companies and hackers and whatnot. And part of it is the history of how the phone technology was always so far ahead of legislation when it comes to surveillance that oftentimes various, whether it was about drugs or whether it was about organized crime, they oftentimes were very innovative on how they tapped the phone. But the laws and the warrants and all that stuff didn't catch up till much later. And so I think we're really seeing this again, which is that the technology is so far ahead of any of our legislation, whether it's about, Patriot Act or not, that what the Patriot Act says is, why don't you go do all these things to stop all these terrible things from happening? And how that's interpreted with technology is much different than I think we thought it would be, because technology goes much faster than any of us think, and the courts are just not able to keep up. Now, with that said, my biggest fear is that there will be a knee-jerk reaction to these leaks, that where we start legislating data privacy. And then we are in a position like Germany, where startups cannot exist there because the laws do not allow them to do the cool stuff that we can do here with data. And so I do a lot of speaking, and I've talked in Germany a bunch, and oftentimes people say, you know, we have all these really strict laws, but our startups are leaving to go to countries that are more permissive.
Yeah, I talked to someone in Germany that said that they had to, that because of something that was built into their startup, they had to actually have a privacy person that was an employee, and there was like six people that worked at the startup, and they couldn't afford it, and therefore they had to go elsewhere.
Well, and the case of Max Mosley is fascinating. So Max Mosley, who is the son of Oswald Mosley, a famous British Nazi, right, Will? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And who is, he's the former head of Formula One and very worried about his father's association. Pictures were shown of him in a British, News of the World, the now defunct Murdoch, you know, trashy newspaper, of him at an orgy. And News of the World said it was a Nazi orgy. Mosley sued. Mosley sued and won. But the problem is, the pictures keep showing up in a Google search.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the Streisand effect as well?
Well, you know, we're talking about it, right?
Yeah.
And so there is a search. But obviously Mosley's made the decision that he'd rather get those pictures out of the Google search index.
By the way, Nazi orgy is an incredible Google search. Just generally.
Now we know what he was doing in San Diego all this time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This week, Paris's Tribunal de Grande Instance, I don't know what that is, Supreme Court, I guess, ruled in Mosley's favor. He sued Google in France to filter the images automatically and delete any links to them. Not to go after the websites publishing the images, but to go after Google search. Now, they only ordered him. They only ordered Google to pay €1 in damages. And Google says it's going to appeal. It raises a really interesting specter. Is it Google's responsibility for what's in their search index? I could see how you could go after a website that publishes those pictures, but Google?
So I always, whenever I hear these stories, I always go back a little bit, and I think that we should have, especially since cameras are everywhere, we should have camera training. Because he should have never filmed this Nazi orgy in the first place.
I don't know if he filmed it.
Never have,
I don't know if it was his movie.
It was set up as a sting.
I think it was featured in it.
I was like, what an idiot. Let's have
if you film a Nazi orgy, whatever happens to you thereafter is your problem.
That's exactly what I was like, what an idiot.
I would not film that.
Come on.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. But Google already filters copyrighted results, right? So Google will filter out, you know, torrent websites if you famously search.
It does, but I think it's a slippery slope.
So shouldn't it try and filter out things which are illegal in particular countries? So it's particular to France because France has got a lot of really strict rules about glorifying war and glorifying Nazi Germany and all these kind of things. And part of the thinking, I think, in that decision was that it relates to that.
I think it also has to do with the EU's doctrine of the right to be forgotten, right?
Yeah, but I think it's more about if you're going to operate in a country, like if you're going to operate in China, right, you've got to play by the rules of China. So Google, you know, did have, and a lot of technology companies have completely different presences in China, right, to comply with local Chinese laws. The problem is that you do start to get to a stage where if you want to be in a country, you've got to play by their local laws. And that starts to get really complicated when you're a massive multinational like Google. On the other hand, they could choose not to do it and not be there, right?
It must be tempting for Google just to say, okay, France, you don't want Google, you don't get Google.
Mm-hmm.
That must be tempting. Well, Google says we have removed hundreds of pages for Mr. Mosley and stand ready to remove others he identifies. I guess that would be on Blogspot or some Google properties. But the law does not support Mr. Mosley's demand for the construction of an unprecedented new internet censorship tool. But Google removes child pornography. This is a problem. Once you start censoring,
yes, that's the problem. It's who is the decider?
You're no longer a common carrier once you censor at all.
Yep, exactly. But that's where I think you can have services that do and services that don't, and there has to be some sort of awareness to let the people know what is happening. I mean, Facebook censors.
Facebook does not censor beheading videos, but don't you dare nurse a child on,
which, by the way, is insane.
Yeah.
But you know, Google makes a lot of effort not to really specifically, and this is might be a nifty segue, makes a lot of effort not to filter YouTube. So there's no manual filtering of YouTube whatsoever. It's all about
They have algorithms that filter YouTube.
Yeah,
I mean, remember
absolutely.
That,
so it's remember so the to cap- avoid that any editorial control, right? So to avoid having to DCMA safe harbor.
But that's the same thing. It's if someone wrote a piece of code that then filters, what's the difference between that and a human being doing it? I mean, so for example, there are systems within YouTube that say, oh, this is actually copyrighted by AMC, and we know that's the same image, so we're going to pull that down. Remember the cat video? The cat people, the cats with the music stuff?
They're playing.
You've described 80% of YouTube videos.
What? Oh, yeah, that cat video on YouTube. Who could forget it? Keyboard cat?
No. Oh, yeah. There were people who were putting these videos up online, these music videos or whatever. They were all stolen.
Yeah.
And so someone came up with the idea.
Let me search for YouTube cat video. I'll see if I can find it for you.
Are you talking about Keyboard Cat? I think you're talking about Keyboard Cat.
No, he's not.
So it's a cat. So what people did was they took a picture, it's a still picture of a cat watching a television, and then they put the video that you want, on the television. Yes.
And did they get away with it?
The algorithm cannot pick it up, so then you can watch the thing. You can get to watch a movie with a cat.
We actually do that all the time. When we show YouTube, when we show copy, because we're allowed, by the way, to show copyrighted material in there's something about a cat video you just can't help but smile.
Here you go. I have it. Oh no, it's been
that
taken
wasn't
down.
It it's been taken out. So we do that, right, Chad? So look, we're a news, this is a news show, right?
Yep.
Pretty obvious. New York Times reporter, you know. It's a news show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're allowed as a news show in the coverage of news to show copyrighted material in that context.
Yep.
Fair use. Nevertheless, we're always, we get DMC requests on almost every video we show. Often the videos are taken down. And then we appeal the process. So what we've discovered, because it's automated. It's just, there's a machine that's running. And sometimes it's like Brazilian television says you can't show that cat video. And it's like, what? So what we do is what do you do, Chad? You put it in a window, right? So like that. Same thing. It's like a cat watching
a
video.
You're a cat watching a video.
I'm a
right
cat
now
watching the news. Oh.
Yeah.
We're watching Leo watch news with his cat.
Maybe, Chad, if we put a cat in that window,
then you won't get the you
won't
get
the takedowns anymore.
Should we move on to something else?
I know what you're going to talk about. PlayStation 4. Excited, are you?
What?
Our show today brought to you by... Let's take a break and we'll talk about PlayStation 4 and other exciting news. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Citrix. If you're an IT or support professional, and I'm guessing like 38% of the people watching this show are actually supporting some... Actually, if you include family and friends, 100% of you, right, are supporting mom or dad or Aunt Liz or you know how it is. You've got to get on there and fix their problem. You got to know about GoToAssist. I'm sure you've heard about their remote access. We've talked about it all the time. I use it all the time with family members. But really, this is for IT pros, people who are doing support, running networks. Maybe you want to take your IT business to the next level, do managed services. This is going to totally blow your mind. The best remote support. They've added three new modules. They've got remote support. They've got the service desk, which allows you to manage incidents, route service desk records, customize a self-service portal with your logo, your branding, seamlessly track changes, incident reporting, problem management. Then they've got the monitoring, which is so awesome. You run the crawler on your client's network. You'll know all the hardware, all the software, everything running on it. You can set up the dashboard that'll let you know when there's a problem proactively. You got the tools to become a support hero. All cloud-based, and if you've been using something similar, and I know there are other companies doing similar things, you will be very impressed with the price. Go to assist.com. I'll tell you what, try it free for 30 days. Please, when you do the try it free, I've got two requests. Make sure you use our offer code TWIT, but also make sure you check all three modules so you get to try the remote support, unattended support, PC, Mac, mobile, You can do up to 8 sessions at once, unattended.
Can I plug in my USB stamps.com thing to this? Or is it,
yes, you can. And it'll see it. And then it'll say, user error, somebody's sitting on the scale. And you say, and then you can come, you can call and you can say, you're not allowed to weigh yourself, that kind of thing. It's great. No Xeroxing of your buttocks. Please enter the promo code TWIT and make sure you check all three of these modules because you're going to want to try all three. They're all three free for the first 30 days. Go to assist.com from Citrix, the leader in remote support, and now in every area, every aspect of IT. Nick Bilton is here. He's the author of a brand new book that is burning up the charts. I'm sure will be number one on the New York Times bestseller list any minute now. It's called Hatching Twitter, Perfect Timing with a Twitter IPO, a true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. You also see him in the Bits blog and on the New York Times website. It's always good to have you on.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Will Harris here from channelflip.com. What are you up to these days, Will?
Still channelflip.com.
All right. And you've moved to London? Is that because
you moved to London?
You want to hang out with the birds in Carnaby Street?
The birds in Carnaby Street with some of them lovelies. Exactly.
Do you drive an Austin Healey?
Wait, where were you before, Will?
Union Jack on it. He's
in
Oxford.
In Oxford.
Oh, okay, got it.
And Nick's a, did you know that Nick's a Brit as well?
Well, I'm from up north in Leeds. Aye.
Oh, very good. Very
did
good.
You have that accent
up in Yorkshire? Aye.
Before? Did you talk like that?
I did. I talked like Will.
Really?
But yeah, honestly, I was born in Darlington and grew up in Leeds.
Wow.
Yeah. Live
you've done well
at
to
Leeds.
Leave that accent.
Yeah. And then you sound like a New Yorker. You moved to New York. How old were you?
Wait, we were hearing Will's story. Let's hear the rest of Will's story.
I know, but I'm fascinated. I just
want to... So you moved to London.
No, so it turns out that working in London and, you know, living 100 miles away is a real pain in the butt.
Yeah.
So I moved to London. It's way easier.
Now that he's sold his company, he works in the city.
In the big smoke. So we've just finished a big run of shows we did on YouTube with Ricky Gervais.
Oh,
so
cool.
You can watch a really cool Ricky Gervais channel on YouTube.
Where do we go to see it?
YouTube.com/RickyGervais.
Wow. That's pretty good.
So that's been really good fun to create. And
he's brought back the David Trent character from The Office, or Brent.
Yeah, so David Brent from The Office. Yeah. So we put that together and brought him back, and the sort of conceit was, what if David Brent was a YouTube star? You know, there's all these guys who are really popular on YouTube and have their own sort of, you know, vlogging channels. David Brent would definitely teach guitar. You know, he would help educate the masses.
It's the funniest thing ever. Did you script this?
Hi. Welcome to Learn Guitar with David Brent.
Was it scripted? Did he ad-lib the whole thing? How did it?
No, it was scripted. It was scripted.
Very funny.
How was it working with him?
He's a really interesting guy to work with because
that doesn't sound good, does it?
No. Keep going.
Genuinely, because he's one of these people that is massively into his social media. So the YouTube channel grew out of the fact, you know, he's got 5 million followers on Twitter, as you will well know, Nick. And it was all about how can I do more things to give the audience on Twitter like more experience, right? How can they get more Ricky? Other than just, you know, stupid photos that he takes in his bathtub or whatever. And so that's kind of what it grew out of. So he's all about trying to reach, you know, the fans directly and do something that's genuinely a bit different.
That's cool.
And now he's doing something called Derek? What is this?
Yeah, that's a TV series which is on Netflix in the States. It's sort of exclusively on Netflix.
Another one of them Netflix exclusives.
Another one of them.
I'll be damned.
And what Harper denounced earlier that he just unveiled his company on Twit. Congratulations.
You got a new book. And I'm just still sitting here.
Wait, we got to hear from Harper next.
We know Harper's got his new thing. Is
got my new thing.
He does look like Jesse Pinkman.
Lunar Tech.
Right?
I don't look like that. No.
No, no, in the video, it's in this in the screen you do.
I do?
Yeah, you right?
There's a little Pinkman in us all, really. That's why we love Jesse so much. There's a little. I feel like Jesse sometimes, chained to my meth lab.
Chained. You'll give away the ending.
You haven't seen it yet?
Really?
No. See, that's what I'm saying. You don't want to spoil it for those guys.
I haven't seen it.
What?
What?
All right. I'm just going to say, I won't say any. No spoilers. It is the best season ender of all, you know, the Sopranos.
I think the Wire season ender was phenomenal.
Really?
I don't know if I got to the last season.
Oh, the Wire was the last season. The Wire. Really? Okay, great. So I'm the jerk.
You're the only one who saw it. All right, I'll watch it now. I watched the first four seasons, and I kind of lost interest.
Okay. But Breaking Bad was that last show.
Perfect.
Phenomenal.
Everything all tied up with a nice little bow. Mm-hmm. And delivered.
The scene with the thing.
Yeah! Man. You know, when Miriam Joire was here, she said, watch the cars in Breaking Bad, because the guy's into cars.
Uh-huh.
Vince Gilligan's into cars. And so, like, remember the Aztec? You had that crap Aztec?
Yeah. That was amazing.
Yeah.
But the cars are fascinating. And in fact, the car plays a large role in the last
episode. I'm not giving anything away by saying this, but I'm honestly not giving anything away. One of the greatest things about Breaking Bad was the fact that you got after the show ended, you went on like Reddit and Twitter and all these places to find all the little secrets and all the things that were hidden.
Right.
And
was there a lot of hidden stuff?
Oh, there's so much amazing
stuff. I gotta do that.
I mean, go look. There's some Reddit forums where people found all the playbacks. You're gonna ruin it for everyone if you do that now.
Well, I won't show it.
Okay. But it was amazing, and there's all of the scenes in the end. There are flashbacks to the beginning, and I'll tell you, there's a great part at the very end that has something to do with something else.
Huh? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. No, I don't.
Best.
That's a great sentence.
So anyway, we have a really remarkable panel of fabulous people. I'm glad to have you all here. This is a lot of fun. You said there was a story you wanted to talk about. You were all excited about, Nick. Before the break.
No, I asked the chat room what they wanted to talk about next, and they keep doing is
PlayStation 4.
Talking about Will's PS4. Poor audio.
No.
PlayStation 4?
Are you excited? Xbox One. Jesse Pinkman. You do look a lot like Pinkman, I gotta say.
Can someone Photoshop his face with a Pinkman
face? Yeah, anything you want.
No, they'll do some.
Oh, like, anything you want, they will do.
Let's get Darth from Twitter. He can do that stuff in like 10 seconds.
Oh, no,
like
our guy's awesome.
Yeah.
Tell us about Britney Spears, the Britney Spears doll.
Oh, someone asked about the FAA ruling. We should talk about that.
Oh, Nick has been. Awesome. Actually, we actually owe a real debt of gratitude.
Thank you.
To Mr. Nick Bilton.
Thank you very much.
Who in the New York Times, in your Bits blog, continually ragged on the airlines and most importantly on the FAA for not allowing you, Nick Bilton, to play Words with Friends whenever you're taking off and landing.
Well, because it was ridiculous. There was no reason the rule existed.
And you did the research. You went out, you went to labs, you tested, you said there's no interference at all from a Kindle. None at all.
We went down to I did the first story in 2011, and I've never had
a
response.
Has it been that long? Wow.
Yeah, I never had a response to a column like that.
Was it a personal vendetta, though? I mean,
no,
it really.
It was just logic. I was sitting on a plane. I downloaded a book to my Kindle, and then the flight attendant said, "You've got to turn that off." And I said, "This is what are you talking about? This is a calculator.
Right.
You can't crash a plane with a calculator."
Right.
And I got really frustrated, and I wrote a column, and I didn't really think anything of it. And it was viewed millions of times. It had 600-700 comments. It was shared on Twitter 10,000 times. And I realized that it wasn't just me that was pissed off.
You
it was everyone.
Nerve, yeah.
Am I allowed to say they were pissed off?
Yes.
Okay.
So you just can't say.
Okay, got it. No, but pissed is okay. Okay, so then I called the FAA and I did this piece, whatever, and then they said the rules that existed were from 1964.
What?
Right? They hadn't changed the rules since. And the rules they said that you're allowed to use a hearing aid, a heart monitor, a tape recorder, and an electric shaver.
What did people have in 1964 that would be dangerous?
Well, apparently they went on the planes with like CB radios and things. So, yeah.
A breaker 19. I'm up here at 40,000 feet.
So then we went down to this testing facility in Palo Alto, and we took a Kindle and a shaver and all these things, and we tested them all. And it turned out that a Kindle a plane has to be able to withstand, from Boeing and FAA's rules, 200 volts per meter of electromagnetic energy. And a Kindle puts off 0 point, and then there's like 25 zeros, 6 microvolts.
Because it doesn't actually do anything it's turning a page.
Well, even if it's turning a page, it doesn't do anything.
Right.
It's like the devices, because they're trying to reduce the amount of power you're using when they build these things. So then what happens, so if you do the math, to hit the 1% mark of the rules, you would need 66,666 Kindles in a 1 square meter area. So you can't physically, and that's just 1%. So if you filled a whole, so anyway, so after after a couple of years of just relentlessly attacking the FAA for the stupidity of these rules, and then everyone else doing it too, and then everyone tweeting it and so on, the rules finally got changed last week. So,
well, and I think it was a cascade because obviously the airlines heard their
the customers.
Users,
people were upset. They paid, you know, you pay $500 for an iPad and you want to just read a magazine. And everyone said, oh, it's 5 minutes. No, it's 31 minutes during takeoff and landing.
You
that's
measured
the average.
It, apparently.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I'm going crazy here. It's 31 minutes.
So people bought these devices and they wanted to be able to read.
I actually buy you've actually now killed the magazine industry. Because that's the only reason people bought magazines at airports.
Of course.
Is for those 10 minutes at either end that you couldn't read.
Well, I apologize to the magazine industry, but I think
People Magazine is now going out of business because of Nick Bilton.
No, because People Magazine can offer a more far superior product on a Kindle or an iPad and make money that way.
All right. From your mouth to Kindle's ear, or people's ear.
Yeah. And can you use your PS4 in takeoff now?
Apparently.
Wait, so what's the story with the PS4?
So it's coming out in a week, November 15th. I don't want to talk about that. But real quickly, JetBlue and Delta were on the FAA commission.
Committee, yes. So they were the first that was able to.
And they got to do it right away.
They did the tests first, yes.
And all the other airlines by the end of the year probably will be able to do this.
Yeah, I think United now can do it. Virgin America still cannot, which I think is ridiculous because they were the ones that spoke to me the most for all these stories.
You'd think so because they're the hippest airline.
And you should ask Virgin America to hurry up their testing.
They also have the newest planes.
I know. They have new planes. They have those cool purple lights and the cool music.
Like a disco in that plane.
It's awesome.
JetBlue posted a video of the first flight. And
with all these devices.
With all the devices. And in fact, the pilot happily using his.
Well, here's the thing, too, that the pilots were using these devices for the last 5 years. It wasn't, you know, they were up in the cockpit telling us to turn off our gadgets.
And
they were
got
in there playing
iPads.
Words with friends on their iPads.
Right.
So,
did Alec Baldwin call you personally and thank you for that?
No, but I did speak to Alec's manager a few months back when things were gearing up. We knew it was going to change, and they were very excited. So
he got in trouble for not stopping. Didn't they throw them off the airplane
And then he live tweeted how he hated the stewardess.
He was playing Words with Friends, and they wouldn't stop. Hey, I'm right in the middle of a. Well, it's not exactly an action game.
No, it's not really.
So here's the first PED approved.
Okay, awesome.
So I know you probably saw Rachel's email that came out yesterday from Sandy.
High quality.
Yes.
So really?
This is what
they're fighting for this for 2 years, and this is how they reward it?
Okay. So I think you saw the You saw the email.
Compliant, so we're good to go. Flight attendants have been briefed.
Wow, look at that. They actually sent a message over the
PEDs will be used.
This is actually the first flight that the FAA has approved, so you guys are lucky enough to do that. With that, we've all rode public transportation. Please be kind to your neighbors and do not.
What about the complaint that now flight attendants have to spend extra time making sure that you're not actually using a radio?
So I interviewed the people on the committee from the FAA testing committee and asked them, well, what happens if I forget to put my phone in airplane mode? And they said that what happened is the planes were originally built. They didn't have a lot of insulation as far as electronics, right? So you had these radio waves and these radar waves and all these things that were going through. So they had to actually about 40 years ago, they had to start making the planes so that they couldn't have interference from the outside. As a result, by accident, they made it so that they couldn't have interference from the inside too. So these devices, even if they're in airplane mode or they're not, it's not going to do anything.
Doesn't matter.
And I have that. It's quoted in one of my columns.
The FCC, not the FAA, regulates cell phone use. And
correct.
That's a different issue because I'm told the handoffs at 600 miles an hour at 7 miles up be a real problem for cell towers.
Yeah, so it's not a dangerous problem.
Right.
What it is it makes it difficult for the cell towers to be able to hand off
right.
the signal. And so I put my phone in airplane mode just to make it
right.
easier for those little cell towers.
Right.
But other than that, you know.
And because I really don't want
to save some
you.
Battery.
And to save some battery.
Save
That's
some
a very
battery.
Good point, Will. It's yeah. probably draining a lot of the battery.
Yeah. It does, because those handoffs
on your PS4.
Kill it immediately on your PS4 or Xbox One. Who's going to be the first person to
use my razor on takeoff? I'm going to be there. What could go wrong?
No, it's crazy that even that they had let people do that and no one did it. What are the rules in England? They're still the same. They haven't changed yet, right?
It's a good question. No, still the same, which sucks.
Yeah.
Real quickly, let's check in. Tom Merritt is sitting in the back there, and he's going to tell us what's coming up this week on Twit and Tech News Today. Tom?
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's some of the things we'll be keeping an eye on in the week ahead on Tech News Today. Monday, November 11th, the Techonomy Conference in Tucson, Arizona is happening. That's also Veterans Day. Tuesday, November 12th, BioShock Infinite's Burial at Sea downloadable add-on launches. New York Times Deal Book Conference happens, and Ignition, the future of digital, also happens in New York City. Wednesday, November 13th, Motorola is teasing the Moto G launch, and then Chegg, the textbook rental company, IPOs. Thursday, November 14th, the PS Vita TV comes to Japan. And Friday, November 15th, Zulily, one of those discounts for moms companies, IPOs on the NASDAQ. Amazon launches its first original TV series, Alpha House. And the PS4 comes out. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Previously on Twit, Triangulation.
Shell Israel and Robert Scoble are here. They've written a new book. Their first book was called Naked Breakfast. No, Naked Conversations. And
this show is already going down.
Know-how.
What if I could make a data-only cell phone using the SIM out of a Verizon LTE iPad?
Surely you must be joking.
Me? I don't joke.
Windows Weekly.
Skype rings on my PC in three different places, which is hilarious. I love that. And I love that when I answer it, it doesn't stop the other two from ringing. That is amazing.
This Week in Google.
The ad's a little creepy because it has a very attractive young woman, and a guy calls her up.
Amy, I like you.
Aw.
Aw. Get out of here, you creeper.
Like, oh, great. I get to give customer support and also get hit on. Awesome.
Twit. Line 10, print I love Twit. Line 20, go to line 10.
Whoa, that's geeky. Oh, that is. Thank you to Jim Cutler for that geeky humor. So you wrote an article about Alec Baldwin back in the day.
Words with Friends.
Words with Friends.
Danger to America's Skies.
Did you... You heard from his management.
Yeah, his management.
Yeah.
I'm not cool enough to talk to Alec.
Nexus 5 arrived in many people's hot little hands this week, announced on Halloween by Google with the new KitKat OS. Any thoughts?
Yes. It's too big.
Too big?
It doesn't fit in my pocket.
It's so big. Really?
What's the point?
What's wrong with 5 inches?
It's huge.
So big.
Really? You guys,
I'm
guessing
for you, it's probably a good size.
iPhone users, right? You skinny little punks.
Yes. No. What's
what do you use? What do you use, Harper?
I have an iPhone.
And Will? I'm sure Mr. Will Harris with one L.
iPhone.
Definitely iPhone.
You have a bunch of Apple.
So what's the? Why do you need a phone that is that big?
Have you ever used a phone with a screen that it just? It's 1080p. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
But wait a second. But what do you do? I mean, I read on this. I'll take some pictures. Sometimes watch a little YouTube clip if I'm on the run.
Really? So
I
this is interesting. Email.
So what else do I need to do?
And then when Apple next year releases a 5-inch phone, what are you going to say?
I'm going to stick with my little phone that
really?
Fits in my pocket.
You like a little phone?
Yeah, I like a little phone.
Me too. Yep.
How about the Moto X? You like something that's kind of iPhone?
I like that one.
Oh, let me see this one.
I love the Moto X, actually.
This one's looking
See, that's
nice.
A good size,
it's
right?
A good size. It's a little wider.
I have a theory that the reason that large phones are selling really well at the moment is because they're handbaggable. Because guys have this issue, which is I want the phone to be small enough to fit comfortably in my pocket, right? And not in my back pocket because I'm going to sit on it. It's got to
fit.
You
put it in your breast pocket,
front,
but all of these do.
No, not your breast pocket, because then it's going to fall out and you're going to break it repeatedly. It's got to fit in your front jeans pocket.
I never bend over. That's my secret. Never bend over.
But so
I learned that in prison.
That's why he likes the 5-inch phone.
Doesn't fit in your pocket. But if you are a lady and you're carrying a handbag, or if you're a man and you're carrying a handbag, let's be equal opportunity about it. You don't care how big it is because you just fling it in the handbag.
Wait, do you carry a handbag, Will?
No.
So
I don't want to say that I couldn't.
But wait, so are you saying that the market, the demographic for 5-inch phones as women with purses?
That is my theory.
Okay.
Well, having a 5-inch phone and very happily.
Have you guys seen the people? Have you seen people when they have those? Bigger than that, like the big ones.
I love the Note 3. That's also
fabulous. What do they do with that?
Oh. Yeah. Wish they were dead.
No, a big phone is nice because it's your computer. This is your number one computer, right?
Yeah, this is my
The phone is the computer you use more than any other computer now.
Yes.
It has become your computer. And so a big screen is just better, just in the same way a big screen's better on a computer.
Okay, here. So this is my iPad mini,
right? Yeah.
So
well, that's a bigger screen.
It's a bigger screen, but I don't.
This is actually a higher resolution screen than your iPad mini.
Well, exactly. But I don't understand. Like, this is a good, there's a good size difference here. I don't need something that's.
That's a good. What are you. It's nuts.
Look at how big that is. The size of it.
All right. I happen to like big phones. I cannot lie. Those other brothers can deny. When a phone walks in with an itty bitty. Never mind. I can't go any farther. Actually, you guys should feel terrible because. Did you read the Cam Simpson article in Bloomberg Business Week?
Yeah.
Very depressing. Oh. And I have to say, it's not the iPhone only. It's every
phone.
It's every consumer electronic device. Even the Moto X, which is assembled in the U.S., still goes down this supply chain to Malaysia and other places. And the story is depressing about how, well, it talks about Apple and how they ramped up to build the camera in the iPhone 5 and how labor is basically brought into Malaysia from Nepal and other places by brokers, that the labor is essentially, this is essentially serfdom. They are required to pay the brokers. They often take out loans. They talk about one worker who took out $1,000 in loans to go to the Flextronics plant near Kuala Lumpur. The plant was shut down because the cameras they were producing were not good enough for Apple. The worker was stranded there for months. At some point, they stopped feeding them. They held their passport so they couldn't leave. He got back home eventually, owes money to what is effectively a loan shark in Nepal, and will have to go out and do it again just to get enough money to pay this back. I mean, it is a tragic story.
Yep.
And my sense is from this that it's universal at Flextronics, which makes a lot of the electronics we use today. It kind of takes a little bit of the fun out of owning and arguing over which is bigger, which is smaller.
Absolutely. Thanks for ruining this. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I'm going to throw them out now.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Yeah.
I mean,
That's it. Well, no, it's difficult because there was when the Times did that big series on, you know, on Apple and the supply chains, and it was not just Apple, it was everyone. It was Samsung.
Everybody
and
makes
Microsoft
everything you use is thing, made. It's, there. It, even Ford, even cars, you know.
There was a great op-ed. I have no idea who wrote it. I can't remember, but there was a great op-ed that said, well, what do you do in this situation? Do you just not have a phone? Or, you know, and I think that.
Well,
you
maybe you don't
try.
Throw it out as soon.
Yeah.
Maybe you keep
it
longer.
That
maybe.
Was exactly what they said, is that
so
you
people
don't.
People only have to be like slightly in servitude rather than totally in servitude. Like, they'd have to make a new phone every 3 years rather than every 2 years.
Yeah. Oh, shucks.
Surely, the answer is well, what happened with the New York Times series with Apple in the first place was that, you know, it started Apple doing a crackdown on its suppliers. And surely the right thing to do is, A, for Apple to insist and actively monitor and actively
and
prevent.
As this article points out, there are laws saying, for instance, you cannot, as a broker, ask for more than a month's worth of pay. These people, by the way, make very little money. This guy, Dong is his name, was earning $3 a day for a 12-hour shift. He earns less than $90 a month. He owes $300 in interest alone every year. So, I mean, we're talking just devastating.
Yep.
I also think the other thing that they can do, which Apple is clearly doing, is start making stuff in places where the labor laws are better. So bring the manufacturing to the U.S.
Well, but when that happens, it's not going to be people that are making it then. It's going to be robots. And that's going to be the big change then. But, you know,
but
I
is
mean,
that better or worse?
Look at the Apple plant at for the Mac Pro. I mean, it's primarily robots making that
thing.
Yeah. That's in Texas.
John Markoff wrote a great piece about this, about how when when manufacturing does come back to the U.S., it doesn't mean it's going to come back with jobs. It means it's coming back and it's going to be robotics that are building it.
But this is effectively slave labor.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think it's unfair just to call out Apple for this because
absolutely
every
not
single
just
a, yeah, company sure. is doing
and
it.
And I prefaced it with that. Every one of these phones is made exactly. Yeah. And even if this phone, like the Moto X, is assembled in Texas, it doesn't matter because every part that they use, from the camera to the rare earth materials, it's mined in horrible ways in China. It's made by slave labor in Malaysia. I mean, we're all a little bit culpable, frankly. And I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I'd rather have robot slaves than actual real slaves.
Absolutely,
yeah, I completely agree.
This is a tough one to bring up because, of course, this is our livelihood. We talk a lot about gadgets.
I would
rather pay more for it, right?
What's that?
Well, would we?
I'd also rather pay more for it. I would absolutely rather pay more knowing that a lot of people will buy food, you know, that's ethically sourced or is organic, like, or, you know, it's free range. You know, who doesn't buy free range eggs now, right? And you just think, well,
not me.
Are we treating chickens better than people?
Yes. Yes. I don't know this phone because it's Europe only. You know about Fairphone?
Yep.
Fairphone.
Mm-hmm.
It's 325 euros, which is you know, a normal price. They're not out yet, but the idea is that it's made in a more equitable fashion. I'd have to read more about it.
And there's also is a Motorola phone that they're building that they're trying to do the same thing, where they're trying to use specs that are, you know, fair labor laws.
It's a modular phone. I think that's a very interesting phone. Well, look, let's all be aware of it as geeks. We like our gadgets, but there is a human price to pay. I don't know. Yeah. You know, by the way, the reason Dong took out this $1,000 loan to go there is the reason brokers can charge people. These are hotly contested jobs. People want these jobs. So it's not that the job itself is menial, although we might, as Americans, look at the job and say $3 a day for gluing sneakers. They want these jobs desperately. That's why they're paying so much money to get them. But once they get there, they're effectively slaves. I hardly want to talk about anything else now.
That.
It's a real downer. Yeah. Apple did buy a big sapphire manufacturing company in the U.S.
I didn't understand what that meant.
I think it's pretty clearly
what it means.
It's taken as a sign that the iWatch is coming, basically, right?
Oh, right.
Because it'll have a sapphire crystal. That sapphire is commonly used in watch crystals. I guess you can't make, you know, they use Gorilla Glass 2 and 3 for these, but I guess you can't make a sapphire.
Well,
or
but
can
they're,
you?
They're going to use a Gorilla Glass underlay because Gorilla Glass can curve. So,
so why are they buying a sapphire company?
I'm not 100% sure.
Sapphire is what they use for the lens covers, right? For phone cameras.
Yeah.
So they made a big thing this time about how the sapphire lens cover wouldn't scratch up on your iPhone.
John Patchkowski, writing for All Things D, said Apple's rumored to be looking at sapphire as a replacement for Gorilla Glass in the next generation touch screens, or it could herald a new device entirely, the long rumored iWatch.
Dun, dun, dun.
Or maybe they're making a TV out of sapphire, a touchscreen TV with a sapphire front. That's surely the next big thing
from
Apple.
That's the next thing.
Yeah.
A curved touchscreen TV.
Apple's warranty canary. When we come back in just a moment, we're going to take a little break. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace.com. Nice New Yorkers who run a pretty nice little company that gives you an amazing deal on your next website. They do the web hosting, plus the fabulous software that makes a beautiful site that never goes down. They constantly improve their platform with new features, designs. Their support is world-class. They've even won a Golden Stevie Award for outstanding service. And the price is right. Gorgeous sites. Now, the beauty of this is you can create a site in minutes. In fact, if you go to squarespace.com, you get see that Get Started button for 2 weeks. No credit card needed. You can set it up and create a gorgeous site. Completely customize it. You don't have to know CSS or JavaScript or HTML even. You can just drag and drop, point and click, add the social media plugins, import content from your existing site. It supports all the major APIs like Blogger and Movable Type, all of that. Search engine optimized, the best hosting, and the price is right. It starts at as low as $8 a month. For $16 a month, you get the amazing unlimited deal. That's unlimited pages, galleries, unlimited blogs, unlimited bandwidth. You never get a bandwidth bill. You could be the hottest thing on the planet, and you wouldn't get a bandwidth bill. Unlimited storage. You can even have unlimited contributors. You could create a site like The Verge on Squarespace for $16 a month. Plus, when you pay for a year ahead, they'll register your domain name for free. They'll hook it all up for you. Great customer support. Lots of training, webinars, everything you need to know to create a great site. If you want to sell, time of year is coming where you might want to get online with your business. If you make something or you have digital downloads, a book or a music you'd like to offer. I'm surprised you wrote with a publisher. Nowadays, the thing to do is just do it yourself. Self-publish. Too much trouble, too much work.
But this site looks beautiful.
Oh, Squarespace. You don't know about Squarespace?
You know, I do. They're
amazing.
Your large screens.
Yeah. Well, if you had a big phone, you'd know.
Yeah, I'd know.
One of the things about Squarespace, all the designs are mobile responsive. So no matter what size screen, it's going to... You have a 27-inch monitor down to a mobile, and it automatically reflows to fit this. It's just really gorgeous what they've done.
It's very pretty.
Try it today, absolutely free. Visit the website, click the Get Started button, spend 2 weeks playing around. If you decide you want to create a Squarespace site, it's great for photographers, bloggers, of course, for sale. If people want to sell stuff, the commerce solution is beautiful. $24 a month when you buy the annual plan. If you decide you want to buy, we're going to take more money off by using the offer code TWIT11. You'll save 10% on your new account. TWIT and the number 11 for the 11th month, squarespace.com. Harper Reed is here. I love Harper. Everybody, people say the phrase Harper Reed, people just love you. I remember playing werewolf at food camp with Harper Reed. He's just wonderful. I loved him even then, even though he was killing me.
I bet you he's a good werewolf player.
He'd wake up and I'd be dead. It'd be terrible. I didn't care.
I just like to shout. That's really the secret to my success is I like to shout a lot.
Nick Bilton, whose new book, Hatching Twitter, is a must-read. At least I read the excerpt, and it was like, wow. There's a lot of drama in this.
There is a lot of drama in that.
Do you think it's more than usual? I mean, you've covered startups. Is it unusually
dramatic? Absolutely. There was, you look at any startup, and there's drama. There's always someone that gets pushed out. There's the forgotten founder. But the thing that was dramatic about this story, and I had no idea going into it this would be the case, but the thing I found utterly dramatic was Noah got pushed out. Then Jack Dorsey got pushed out. Then Jack organized a coup to push Evan Williams out. Then there was a point when Dick Costolo got fired for a brief moment. But the chaos is also what led it to be the company it is today.
Was it because there was going to be so much money that it got this way?
No, none of them really cared about the money. They cared about the influence and having their name out there and the power. And you know, the money, I think, was secondary.
You talk about... Oprah.
Oprah, yes.
There's a chapter called Oprah. This is during the Ashton Kutcher era where the celebrities are everything. And you talk about at Twitter's offices in San Francisco, engineers monitored the site as people kept signing up because Oprah mentioned it, right?
Yes, so Oprah originally, there was the contest between Ashton Kutcher and CNN to see who would get to the first million users.
Right.
And Oprah, I guess, is friends with Ashton Kutcher somehow. I guess they hang out maybe.
They're all celebrities. You know, they all
know
each
other. Is
that what
happens? Sure. They all just like party together?
They just hang
out. So Oprah just said, well, let's talk about this Twitter thing. I don't know what it is. Let's talk about it on the show. And next thing you know, it ended up becoming Evan Williams going on the show as a guest.
Right.
And the funny thing was when Oprah sent her first tweet. It was in all caps, and she's not very good with computers. So they actually set up a computer. It was a PC. They set it up on her table and for live television, 7 million people watching. And the plan was Oprah would tweet, and all of her celebrity friends like Ashton Kutcher and whoever the heck else would respond and say, hey, welcome to Twitter, Oprah.
I remember that.
And she didn't know how to actually hit refresh on a browser. So they set up like the F7 key with a yellow piece of tape that would refresh the browser, right? So she typed her tweet, and rather than hitting return to send the tweet, she actually hit F7, so the tweet was deleted. So there was no tweet for anyone to respond to, and as soon as they cut to commercial break, Evan Williams body checked her and wrote the first tweet.
Out of my way, Oprah!
And hit send, and it was all saved.
The tweet was, hi, Twitters. Everybody knows it's Tweeples.
Tweeples?
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you for a warm welcome, feeling really 21st century, all in caps.
So Evan Williams actually sent that tweet.
That's actually really interesting to hear. Anonymous created a bot to try to beat
to 1 million. Little side story.
Yeah.
Harper, you were about to say something?
I loved watching that.
The anonymous bot.
It was just so awesome.
So here's something that, like,
Demi Moore goes, this is bigger than the American Idol finale.
There's a here. You got you know what title you have to read aloud. Since
I know which chapter, and I'm not going to read it.
No,
aloud.
You're going to say it. What say this? This chapter title.
I know which
title.
Chapter. I know. I saw it. Page 130. F word. Why is somebody saying FFF?
You got to read it. The reason someone's saying FFF is because they accidentally sent an email that was meant to go to the board saying that Jack was going to be fired.
But it was just the F word 18
times.
And
they, before that, had included Jack on the email saying he was going to be fired.
Oh!
And then they sent that email.
God.
Saying...
and then wrote, Jack, please call me when you get this message.
Oh,
it says, out of context, this could be really confusing.
What it will say?
Just saying that those are just like the things that define your existence.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're going to dine out on that story for a long time.
The worst. Yeah.
Out of context, being fired meant something else. it's complicated.
We were firing you.
But then Jack came back and was running it in addition to Square. He'd go across.
He wasn't really running it in addition to Square.
How did you do that?
It was, well, you got, yeah. I mean, that, a lot of it, this is the thing. I mean, this is the reality of the Valley is there are these creation myths.
Right.
And for some reason, creation myths have to take out people that were involved. I mean, Noah Glass. Like, he was written out of the story.
I really feel for him.
And without Noah Glass,
there
would not have been. No, you can't do that.
I got to
read
the last page. I got to.
No, don't do it.
I can't, man. I got to read it.
I'm going to body check you and F7 your computer.
I got to read it.
Without Noah Glass, that company wouldn't exist. And yet he was written out of the corporate history because it made a better creation story.
The story is Jack Dorsey invented Twitter.
Well, that's not the case. And that's what the book tells the story of is that there were 12 people in the room that were there when this thing was hatched.
They weren't out on the swing set in South Park.
The swing set is like one part, but that's like saying that one moment of this show is the entire show.
Right.
You know, there's
12 people that get credit for
it. Well, there's 12 people that are involved in it. But the real genesis, the real moment was a moment in a car with Noah Glass and Jack Dorsey. And it was 2 in the morning. It was February 27, 2006. They'd been out drinking. And they were having this conversation about the status idea and people weren't really interested in it. It wasn't very compelling. But Noah was going through a divorce and he felt incredibly alone. And he had this epiphany and he said, what if you could take this status thing and integrate it with your friends and you could actually feel less alone? And that was like the aha moment.
Very cool. What rhymes with ass word?
Password.
You know where I'm going, don't you, Harper?
Yeah.
Sophos published an article. Of course, the Adobe database that was stolen and then immediately put on the internet. Adobe initially said it's about 3 million customer records. It turned out to be 38 million customer.
No big deal.
Huh?
No big deal.
No big deal. The entire database recently published online, 4 gigabytes. And it turned out, no, in fact, not even 38 million, but 150 million records of Adobe customers, many of them including, yes, encrypted names and passwords, but unencrypted password hints. And when you see a password hint like, and this is an actual password hint, rhymes with ass word, you're gonna kind of know. Or the password is password.
Are you allowed to say ass word on here?
No. So what do you think this is? No. In the cause of helping people with their
this show
words,
is literally going to sound like a fax machine to people.
Beep, 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 beep. So Sophos did a very interesting study of these databases and, in fact, was able to decrypt a great many because, well, it turns out the number one password, 123456, has the same exact Adobe encryption result, 110EDF2294FB8BF4. So they were able to search the database and they found everybody whose password was 123456. They made a list of all the most popular passwords on here. And you'd be amazed at the most popular passwords. 1.6% of all the passwords were 123456. The second most popular password.
People actually use the word password for their password?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, this is not just, oh, I'm going to log into Adobe. This is you got your credit card because you're buying stuff from Adobe. Your credit, it's got all your information in there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 was the next one. Life hack was popular. That's because it's a, I guess, life hack. This is the life hacker password. What is this?
So they compare, because they don't actually have the
password. They're comparing it to Gawker's results. I got it. So, but where is the Adobe list? Is there an Adobe list on here? I thought I had it before.
It's just the hash, so it's kind of confusing.
No, but they were able to reverse engineer it, weren't they? And
no, they just reverse
engineered it. Okay, so that was the life hacker that Gawker won.
It is amazing that in the 21st century, people still use password as a password. I mean,
also popular.
They are such passwords.
QWERTY, ABC123, and 11111.
Wait, people use the word QWERTY?
Yeah, because it's Q, W, T, Y. Also very popular, ASDF and FDSA. So if you're, I mean, this is the real problem. I mean, anyway, thank you, Adobe, for making this all possible. And I got the letter, as I'm sure everybody did, saying your password's been hacked. Please change it. Oh, and by the way, we're going to give you a free year of Experian credit protection, which is, in fact, not germane at all, since all that protects you against is identity.
So I was reading that there's going to – oh, you know what? Your big phone, your 5-incher over there, it has the facial –
My 5-incher, yeah.
It has the facial recognition thing.
Really, in here?
Yeah, it works.
You mean for logging in?
For logging in, yeah.
It absolutely
works. I've
used that on Samsungs, but it works better on the Google.
It works really, really well. Yeah, that was the one thing I actually got excited about with that phone, but it's too big and won't fit my pocket, so I can't use it.
What do you got? I don't understand where these little baby pockets.
But so here's the thing: I was talking to these. I was talking to this guy who works with sensors and smartphones and so on, and he was saying that the way you hold your phone, you have almost like a physical password. So I hold my phone at a certain angle, and I probably move my hand around a little bit and so on, and eventually, just by picking up your phone and the temperature, the sensors that will be in there and all these things, that will be your password. And it'll essentially just...
Because that's unique.
That's unique.
When you put that all together, it's as good as a fingerprint.
It's like a physical fingerprint.
Okay. And then when Face Lock can't unlock it, I'm going to use this. Okay. Continue. All right.
It's really cool.
So let's see. Because I gave it my face. And, you know, the fingerprint works great on the 5S.
Yeah, no, it works really well.
But let's see if the... So I'm going to turn off the phone. And I'm going to turn it on, and it's going to say, look at me. Okay? Wait a minute. It didn't
work. Well, you...
I didn't look at it. So I got to turn it on with me looking at it, right?
Yep.
It worked.
It worked.
All right, now.
Now try with
Nick. Now, let's do it with Nick Bilton and see if he can unlock it. No, do it again.
It's not working.
No, come on. You can look just like me. I bet you can look just like me. Oh, it worked. That's good.
Well, Nick, now you look just like Jesse Pinkman.
All right, Harper, let's see if it can do it on TV. Harper Reed on TV. Does he look just like that? Nope. See, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool, right?
That's good.
It's pretty cool.
But the thing is, let's
it's not as good as
my little phone over here. My little baby phone.
Yeah.
Just put my little thumb on my little phone, and it just opens. I don't need to put.
I do love that. No, I do love that. I think that is really remarkable, and I'm impressed as hell. Bitcoin soars over $266, a new all-time high. Anybody
got any? Bitcoins?
I do. I have some bitcoins.
I love bitcoins.
Do you?
Yes.
Is that how you want to get paid in future?
No.
Do you have any bitcoins?
No. I've never worked out what I would want to buy with Bitcoin.
Drugs, of course.
Have people killed. Well,
but you can't do that anymore, right? So I feel like I've come to
Well, this is the funny thing. The Silk Road is back.
What?
But, okay, so the Fed seized it. Yeah. They think they found the guy who was working in plain sight in San Francisco.
Yep.
They seized millions of dollars in Bitcoins, which I don't know what they're going to do with. And then the site comes back.
So
would
you
buy drugs on Silk Road now?
Okay, but here's the thing. I've been obsessively reading about this guy. So his nickname was the Dreaded Pirate
Roberts.
Pirate Roberts. who in the movie is multiple people, right?
Ah, so there is no Dread Pirate Roberts.
Yes,
there's many Dread Pirate Roberts. There's many.
So I think that while they caught one guy, there are still multiple Jesse Pinkmans out there.
Uh huh. So why do you love Bitcoin, Harper Reed?
I think it is fascinating that I can plug a bunch of little things into a wall and it will output money, even though it's not very efficient right now because of the difficulty has been raised. But
right.
When I first started playing with it, it really was playing. I'm not a professional Bitcoiner by any means, but it's just so weird that you can just do math and money comes out. That's a very strange concept for
money
me.
Comes out.
Right, so the mining, I just don't understand it. I'm just like, okay, I'll just plug all these USB things in, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, you're talking about Bitcoin mining? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It feels
Steve Gibson
like science fiction.
Got early into the Bitcoin mining thing, and magically it mined 50 bitcoins. He's got 50 bitcoins. It's worth over $10,000 now. Just happened like that. But this was a few years ago. Now, the way the algorithm works. The more people are working at it, the harder it is. They want to keep it kind of even. So now it's very difficult to
very
win.
Difficult. Now I'm making about $2 a day on my mining.
You're mining?
Yeah.
Really?
Have you found anything on your mines with your mine?
Not yet. Only $2 a day, which is ridiculous.
Do they know how many bitcoins are left available to find?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How many?
You're not finding bitcoins. You're solving problems and then earning.
How many can you mine for, like,
there's an amount. I can't remember. Where do we go to find that out? The Bitcoin Foundation, probably.
I would have no idea.
Yeah, but
there was a company this week that had was like a Bitcoin bank, right, or a Bitcoin sort of banking service that had
ATM.
Like all the bitcoins stolen.
Right, not so good.
Oh, that was inputs.io, was it?
Yeah,
yeah.
How did they steal them? Did they break into the?
Well, that's a good question.
Bank
hackers.
Probably bad the people guys. That DM you porn stuff on Twitter.
They took 4,100 bitcoins.
11 million mined, 21 million to go, someone said in the chat room. Wow.
And they estimate it's set up in such a way that it won't be till 2040 that all 21 million are mined.
Wow.
So this is going to take a while. We actually did, we interviewed the founder of the guy who runs the Bitcoin Foundation on Triangulation some time ago, about 2 months ago. Very interesting story.
Wow.
Monkey 1, 2, 3.
Do you think you guys think that this guy that was caught is the guy?
I don't know. I don't really trust the feds to have figured this out, to be honest. And it was interesting, the story, the way they did it, he had when Silk Road started, somebody went on forums and said, what do you think of this Silk Road thing? And then they and eventually there was a email address associated with it, and they were able to trace it back. It's kind of an interesting story.
Where did you read that one?
Who told the story of the?
I read the interview with him in San Francisco Magazine, where he denied he didn't. He said,
he said it no. Huh?
And then I read the Forbes actually found the people, the roommates that he had.
Yeah,
and they said all he did was to sit in his room and use his computer.
Name is Ross Ulbricht. I think it was Forbes.com that had the this very interesting story of how the feds, and they say they've seized 28 million in bitcoins from him.
Ross Ulbricht,
who was. So it started with a forum post. Scroll.
What's the title of that piece?
I think this is the one. Maybe not. I'll have to do a little bit more of a search. It's a really great detective. It's a movie.
Well, it's already got a movie deal.
It already has a movie.
Yeah, it already has a movie.
There you
deal.
Go. They waste no time.
And then there are also two documentaries being made. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a great thriller. It's
Well, has anybody seen the new Wikipedia movie?
No, apparently that's awful. I'm told that Assange hates it. WikiLeaks. Assange hates it.
Sorry, WikiLeaks.
So this is the article.
Well, Assange hates everything.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Kashmir Hill writing for Forbes.
What's the title of it? Does
this $17 million Bitcoin wallet belong to alleged Silk Road creator Ross Ulbricht? They start with an identity called Altoid. Altoid apparently put forum posts up. Maybe this isn't the story either. It's a really good story. Maybe this links back to a BBC story. Yeah, this is it.
What is it?
BBC story, how the FBI closed in on suspect Ross Ulbricht. See, the reporter. Oh. So you're going to steal this story and write it up on the Bits blog, and then that way... Yeah. No, you wouldn't do that.
No. I'm going to tweet it.
That's a lot easier. In a post titled Anonymous Market Online, a user nicknamed Altoid started publicizing the site. This is back in 2011. The post contained a link to a site hosted on WordPress that provided a link to Silk Road's location on the dark web, because, of course, you had to be running Tor to get to Silk Road. But then Altoid appeared in another place, a discussion site about virtual currency, bitcointalk.org. And then he appeared again months later in October in a post asking to find an IT expert with knowledge of Bitcoin. He asked people to email rossulbricht@gmail.com. Could have been a giveaway.
That's smart. Maybe he was framed.
Maybe he was framed. The FBI then linked this address to accounts on Google Plus and YouTube. By the way, did you see that one of the founders of YouTube is pissed off?
He's very angry.
He's pissed. He's miffed. He's peeved.
He's pissed, and he's talking about it not on Google Plus.
He does not like it that in order to comment now on YouTube, you have to... What is it, Chad? Do you have to go through Google Plus? YouTube now requires a Google Plus account to comment. Is that right?
Yes.
And he says, why the f***? Damn it.
Gosh.
What is wrong with people with all this profanity? What is going on?
Beep, 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 beep.
Jawed Karim, one of YouTube's original creators, says, why the F do I need a Google Plus account to comment on a video?
Well, but you know what? As much as I want to kind of take it out on Google and those guys, Jared doesn't really have much to say. I mean, he's a bajillionaire, right? And he sold the company.
It's not
his company. They want to make it pink and put it only on 5-inch phones for people like
you. He's got some money.
Then that's what they can do.
But also, how much sort of user insight data do you think he has access to right now versus the engineers working on YouTube?
Correct.
I think what's been really interesting, though, has been that a lot of the YouTube community have kind of gone nuts over this. So the most popular YouTuber in the world is this guy, PewDiePie.
Wait a minute. PewDiePie is the most popular YouTuber in the world.
PewDiePie is the most popular YouTuber in the world. He's got about 15 million subscribers. Wow. And he has turned off comments on his channel in protest.
Wow.
Truthfully, though,
50 million
are comments not the worst on YouTube anyway? I mean,
This might be the best thing that could have happened to YouTube.
It associates it with a real person, and it might make a big difference, I would.
Will, why is PewDiePie so popular?
He's got 15.5 million subscribers.
So many answers to that question.
He's a guy from Sweden who likes to laugh and make other people laugh. I could say that about me.
Are I love these new comments.
What, that you're from
almost,
Sweden?
Almost.
he's a cute guy, and a lot of the main audience, the most obsessive audience on YouTube is, teenage girls. And they love watching him, and he's quite funny.
He posted this 2 days ago, and it has 1.6 million views. He's wrestling with a bear.
Yeah.
How are you doing? I mean, how's it going, man? And welcome to Fist of Awesome. It's not about fisting, as you may think.
I will never understand
suggested
YouTube.
This game.
1.6 million views for that.
What is he doing?
Chad, you're a young person.
Yeah.
You have red hair.
Well, I happen to do a show called This Week in YouTube.
You do a show called This Week in YouTube on this very network.
Why, Will?
What is with PewDiePie?
Well, there's a lot of ideas, theories, and one of them is that...
the fact that you have to have a theory as to why this guy's big really tells me there's a problem.
One is that YouTube really, really cares about minutes watched. And if you're watching gameplay, you're going to get through the entire video. You're not going to...
Is this Minecraft? What is this game?
What he's playing looks like it's on an iPad or something like that. I'm hesitant to play his audio because he is also a cursor.
He swears a lot.
Yeah, he's almost as bad as you guys.
I use the F word more.
Almost
really
as bad.
Because that's clearly the secret. Why, Will? Right. You have Channel Flip. You're a big YouTuber yourself.
This is.
It must be frustrating. You create a lot of great content, and here's some guy from Sweden. He looks like Adam Curry.
Absolutely.
This is the show.
It is. Oh, and looking like Adam Curry is not a great recommendation. So,
like a young, attractive Adam Curry.
Before he sold out.
Yeah.
So I think there are a few things. So number one is that video game footage, which is what this guy does a lot of, is just insanely popular on YouTube. And that is, you know, it's partly the Machinima effect, right? So Machinima is the biggest YouTube content network.
Right.
So what he has managed to do is combine some of the most popular things on YouTube. He's combined comedy with the Justin Bieber effect of being a cute teenage guy, combined with being an amazing, you know, not amazing, but an entertaining video gamer. And so he sort of created this sort of unholy trio of appealing to teenage boys through being all about video games.
That's the key, isn't it?
Girls through being cute.
You got to appeal to kids. No, but you got to get kids to love you if you're really going to be big on this stuff, don't you think?
And there is also a law on YouTube, which is a kind of, it's the sort of Rolling Stone law, which is sort of once you get to, getting to a million subscribers on YouTube is really, really hard.
Right.
Getting to 2 million is then quite easy. And then getting from 2 to 10 is just a matter of time because the YouTube algorithm rewards popularity and surfaces stuff to people, you know, if other people think it's popular.
Very interesting.
And so whilst it's really hard to get a certain level, then once you get to sort of a million subs, it just snowballs.
We're going to wrap it up. I just want a little mention of the Internet Archive. We interviewed Brewster Kahle on Triangulation before. They're great. They do really great work, and they had a massive fire that destroyed $600,000 worth of digitizing and scanning equipment. They really are an important part of, I think, of the Internet. And if you can help, we invite you to do so at archive.org. They're trying to raise money to help pay for
terrible.
Terrible.
Yeah.
If anything should not have burned, it's this, not, you know, nonprofit, really a great boon to the world effort. And it is a nonprofit, so your deduction, your donation is tax deductible.
Did one of his little dolls explode?
Wait a minute. He has dolls?
Doesn't he make little doll statues of all of his previous employees?
What?
What? That's creepy.
What are you talking about?
I didn't ask him about that, but I'd like to know more.
I'm pretty sure that this is real. I have no idea the Google search to get this out.
You know, I know some of his former Waze employees. I'll ask them, and I'll let you know. Kahle started Waze, which was an internet database company, sold to AOL, took that money and created the Internet Archive. And he is a great humanitarian, whether he makes little dolls of his employees or not.
It's true. So there's a picture. This is the weirdest thing in the world. I'm going to go and paste this.
I'm just going to Google Brewster Kahle. Oh, they're Balinese dolls. No?
I pasted it into the IRC.
Wow.
So there's an article on SF Gate. There you go.
Oh, that's weird. They're dolls. He doesn't stick pins in them or anything, does he?
No, they're the archives of his former employees, the physical archive. I mean, I think it's amazing, and this is one of my favorite. I think this is one of my favorite things on the internet, archive.org, and what he does is truly one of the best things that
it's
you could possibly
work.
Do.
Yeah, and don't let the dolls stop you from contributing.
I think that just adds to it.
It just adds to it. It makes me want to contribute more.
Maybe the building is great, too.
Yeah, it's a library. We are doing a survey of our audience. I invite you to participate, twit.tv/survey. It takes a little time, but it really helps us understand our audience, what you like, what you don't like. And I'll be frank, it also helps us tell advertisers what it is in aggregate. We never collect individual information. We can't. You won't be asked for individual information. But in aggregate, what our audience is, so that we can say to them, it's just a bunch of geeks, basically. I don't think we even need the survey to tell you that. Hey, it's so great. Thank you, guys. Thank you for sticking around. I know you got to get out of here. I'm going to let you go, Nick.
Pleasure.
You're going to miss your party.
I don't have a party.
Oh, okay. Nick, you just wanted to have an out in case.
No, I actually had to. I changed. Yes.
You changed your plans? Thank you.
I changed my plans so I could. I didn't want to have to like, those... run off and be some.
No, yeah. I appreciate that.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah.
I love you.
I love you, Nick.
Can we have a moment right
Can
now?
Did you really used to have a Leeds accent?
I really did have a Leeds accent, yes.
And you lost it when you moved to New York?
I lost it when I moved to England. From England. I was 13 when I arrived in Florida. And
so in defense.
And the first place I went was
Fuddruckers.
Yeah.
And I had my first ever panic attack because I realized how the cultural
very different
difference.
Here. Yeah.
And then I lost my accent. But I used to
can you do
so
it now?
Many girls in school.
When oh, yeah. I was, girls love the English.
Like, they'd be like, are you the English guy? And I'd be like, yes. And they'd be like, say something. I'd be like, what do you want me to say? And they'd be like, oh, my God, he's so
he's
cute.
So cute. I want you to talk like that now.
But I never actually picked up the girls. I just, they thought it was cute. So, yeah.
It is really cute.
I was scared of them.
You know who else talks with
well,
a British
that's a
accent?
Great moment to end on, everybody.
Will with one L Harris. Love Will having you here, he Will. Channelflip.com. Will,
I feel like I need to get Will with one L Smith after.
Go to YouTube.com/Ricky Gervais to see what he's up to. Very funny. David Brent plays, teaches the guitar.
And follow me on Twitter at Will Harris.
One L.
One L.
Please.
One L.
No Smith.
Very important.
Please.
Will, I'm actually thoroughly impressed with your intelligence of YouTube. I'm going to call on
He's
you
a master.
For YouTube questions.
There you go.
It is occasionally something that I know a little bit about.
No, it was very impressive and informational.
Harper Reed, also great to have you at Harper on Twitter. And looks just like Jesse Pinkman. It's true.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 2300 UTC on twit.tv. If you want to watch live, we love it if you do, because as you can see, the chat room carries a lot of weight here. But if you can't watch live on-demand audio and video, always available after the fact. If you'd like to join us in studio, as 20 or 25 very lucky people have today, you just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. And maybe we'll put Nick Bilton's book under that chair.
Under it?
Well, only if it's wobbly.
Get a copy of the book.
And you! No, we only have a couple. Hey, thanks everybody for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can.
Wait, what is the name of this twit?
Ah, that's the fun part.
Yeah, twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby.
Oh, Leo, you're such a bad person.
I don't like to overuse it, but occasionally it's fun to use it.
I don't get to use it in at the New York Times, so I it's whenever I'm not at the New York Times, I just use it
like crazy. Well, we try to. We
are
basically
are we talking about?
Yes.
I use it like a fucking comma,
and that's our title.
I use it like a fucking comma.